to you. Thanks so much for tuning in to another edition of Gammon Company right here on NRA TV, Sirius XM, Patriot 125, iHeartRadio, iTunes, and more. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Cam Edwards, your host, glad you've joined us today. And a very busy show for you. Gabby Franco is going to join us, native of Venezuela, host of NRA's Tips and Tactics, talking about the mother of all protests. That's what they're calling the protests on the streets of Caracas and other Venezuelan cities today. This comes in the wake of Nicolas Maduro arming some 400,000 members of his militia, quote-unquote militia, basically his supporters. That, by the way, comes 5 years after Hugo Chavez banned the civilian possession of firearms. Now Maduro, who took over for Chavez after Chavez died, Maduro arming up his followers, his opponents disarmed, his political opponents disarmed. And Maduro today saying that the, quote, hour of combat has arrived. Now, he's not talking about defending Venezuela's borders from outside forces. No, he's talking about the hour of combat has arrived to go after these political opponents. We have seen already today at least one student protester shot and killed in Caracas by security forces. And it looks like the ugly turn that has long been dreaded in Venezuela may be unfolding before our eyes. Well, again, we'll talk about it with Gabby Franco here in about 20 minutes. Andrew Langer with the Institute for Liberty will be with us later on in the hour as well, talking about last night's special election in Georgia's 6th District. Alyssa Milano wants to puke. Yeah. Sorry, Alyssa. Actually, not really. John Ossoff, the favored Democrat, one of, I think, five running, but he got the lion's share. I think all of the other Democrats combined got less than 1% of the vote. So everybody on the left had thrown all of their weight behind John Ossoff, a ton of cash coming into John Ossoff. And if he had won last night, if he had gotten over 50% of the vote, he would have been elected to Congress. That did not happen. He got about 48% of the vote. A little bit better, I think, than Hillary Clinton's share of the vote in November, like maybe a point better, which is a moral victory, apparently, for Democrats. Another one of those moral victories out there. But this really was a race that they thought they could come in and win. They thought, given the closeness of the vote for Donald Trump in November, given the high amount of outrage on the base of the left right now, that would energize voters. And in fact, the early vote totals were incredibly strong for John Ossoff. I think the early vote was somewhere around 71% for John Ossoff. But the election day vote clearly was not with John Ossoff. Now, there were 11 Republicans who were running in this jungle primary. Karen Handel coming in second place. So she and John Ossoff will square off in a runoff on June 20th. But, you know, again, Democrats banked a lot of votes before Election Day. And then on Election Day, weren't a whole heck of a lot of Democrats left to cast their votes. Turnout was really strong. It was much higher than what you would typically expect for a special election. More along the lines of a midterm election turnout. So everybody got their voters out there, but chalk it up to another moral victory for Democrats in Georgia, who are now, by the way, starting to wonder, okay, not just in Georgia, but around the country, okay, so enough of these moral victories. When do we actually get to win one of these special elections? So this is one of the things that Democratic strategists, party consultants are very concerned about, that this energy is going to dissipate. You know, you can only go to so many protests. You can only volunteer so often. When you keep losing, right, makes it harder to kind of keep up that energy. So they're starting to get a little concerned about a lack of energy on the left. I would imagine that they're probably still a good, you know, 3 or 4 months worth of protesting that'll keep him going. But they probably are going to have to see some electoral success somewhere along the line. Next hour, Rhonda Ezell will be with us with Chicago Guns Matter. You know, Rhonda has been fighting the city of Chicago for pretty close to a decade now, challenging their gun laws, particularly over the last 7 years or so since the McDonald decision handed down, challenging the city of Chicago's ban on gun ranges in the city. And they had an outright ban, and then the courts told them can't do that, so they changed the law so that theoretically you could open up a gun range, but practically speaking, there wasn't any space in Chicago that would fit the criteria. So the plaintiffs, including Rhonda Ezell, went back to court, and court told Chicago once again, can't do this. We thought we made ourselves clear. You can't actually do this. So now the city has revised its rules yet another time, supposedly trying to comply with the court's decision. But look, the proof's going to be in the pudding. The proof is going to be whether or not a range can actually open up in the city of Chicago, a city of 2.7 million people. You can't tell me that there's not a place where a gun range can open up for business. And you can't tell me that there is not a demand among legal, law-abiding gun owners in the Chicagoland area for a range inside the Chicago city limits. So the city of Chicago can say, oh, yeah, we're compliant with the court's order. But the test is going to be whether or not a range can actually open up. We've seen this in Washington, D.C. as well. D.C. has many, many ranges, none of which are open to the public. We have more law enforcement agencies per capita in Washington, D.C. than any other city in the country. Most of those have their own range facility. Not all of them, but many of the federal agencies do. But there are no ranges open to the public. Now, that comes, you know, we're 9 years out from the Heller decision. And Washington, D.C. zoning laws don't, again, specifically forbid the construction of a range. They make it theoretically possible. But practically speaking, it's not going to happen. I saw a story about a year ago. We talked about it on the show. Pennsylvania Avenue Northeast. Supposedly a range was going to be opened up in Washington, D.C., and it was coming, and it was going to be great, and I haven't heard anything about that in, about a year, I guess. So we'll talk about that with Rhonda Ezell coming up next hour. Seton Motley with Less Government going to join us as well. In Hour 3, Brian Ben-Simon with Students for Concealed Carry, the anti-gun group at University of Texas Austin, trying to get some attention once again. This time, they had their sex toy protest. That got on the Daily Show. Now they have a new video spoofing campus carry with the introduction of fake products like bulletproof hoodies and things that every college student will need when they go to school there in Texas. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, in the real world, haven't been any incidents there on the campus at University of Texas Austin or anywhere else across the Lone Star State. But we'll talk about it again with Brian Ben-Simon coming up in Hour 3. Also, our friend Stephen Cruiser from IJ Review will join us on the program to finish things off. We have our hero of the day. We have our deal of the day. Good guy. Legislative updates from all around the country. A history file because, you know, it is April 19th, 242 years ago. The battles of Lexington and Concord were fought in Massachusetts, once the cradle of liberty, now the ever-loving arms of the nanny state. Things have changed quite a bit in the 242 years. In my favorite book, by the way, if you're looking for a good book to read about Lexington and Concord, bar none, my favorite is Paul Revere's Ride by David Hackett Fisher. It's great. Absolutely fantastic. Gets into, obviously, Paul Revere's ride, but also spends a great deal of time talking about the events of April 19th, the Battle of Lexington and Concord, and really the running battle from Concord back to Boston. That's sort of, you know, in our mental history of the Battle of Lexington and Concord, we maybe think about Lexington Green and then the Redcoats marching on Concord and the North Bridge and don't fire until you see the whites of their eyes. And then they fought, and then what? Then the Declaration of Independence happened at some point, right? So how did the British get back to Boston? They had to march back to Boston through a hostile countryside. And every minute you had more and more farmers, more and more mechanics, more and more men of all walks of life who were arriving with their muskets, who were arriving with their friends and with their family. And they attacked the British all the way back to Boston. In fact, the British line nearly broke as they were marching back from Concord to Lexington. They were sort of saved by British reinforcements there at the Lexington Green. That's a part of the fight that most Americans just don't know about it. Again, we know the real basics, right? It was a shot heard around the world. Paul Revere warned the British are coming, the British are coming. Actually, he didn't even say that because at the time, everybody was British. It was the Redcoats, the regulars were coming. But in David Hackett Fisher's book, Paul Revere's Ride, David Hackett Fisher talks about an interview that was conducted in 1843 with a guy named Levi Preston, who was a captain in the Continental Line during the American Revolution. He was 91 at the time. He was 20 in 1776. So he was a young man in April of 1775. 19 years old. Had already lost both of his parents, actually. So he might have been a young man, but he was a man. And a guy named Mellon Chamberlain interviewed Levi Preston in 1843, and he asked him, "What made you go fight?" And Preston said, "What did I go for? Like, nobody made me. What did I go for?" And Chamberlain said, "Yeah, were you oppressed by the Stamp Act?" And Levi Preston looked at him, and he said, "I never saw any stamps." He said, "I always understood that none were sold." Was it the tea? Mellon Chamberlain said. Levi Preston said, "Tea tax? I never drank a drop." He said, "The boys threw it all overboard." Mellon Chamberlain said, "I suppose you've been reading Harrington and Sidney and Locke and all these other writers talking about the eternal principles of liberty, right? I mean, like, that must have inspired you to get out there and fight." Levi Preston said, "I never heard of those guys." He said, "The only books we had were the Bible, the Catechism, Watts' Psalms, hymns, the Almanacs." Chamberlain was really confused at this point. Okay, so it wasn't the Stamp Act, wasn't the tea, wasn't that you were stirred by these voices of the Enlightenment. What the hell made you go out there that day? What made you go and stand there with your rifle in your hands or your musket in your hands, looking out across that bridge at the soldiers in their scarlet coats? What made you do that?" And Preston said, "Young man, what we meant in going for those redcoats was this. We always had been free, and we meant to be free always. And they didn't mean we should." You know, sometimes we can sort of look at things from the 30,000-foot level, right? And what were these worldwide events, shaping events in the colonies, and how, you know, a butterfly flaps its wings in Brazil, and there's a hurricane in Malaysia. And sometimes, for those individuals involved in a historic act like the Battle of Lexington and Concord, it isn't about the scholars and the commentariat, whether it's on our cable television sets or in, you know, books written by Locke. It's not necessarily the daily political events that drive us. It's not the Stamp Act. It's not the tax on tea. It's not one of these individual events that inspire people, that make people stand up for their principles, that make people say, you know what, no more. And not just a person, but a nation. Sometimes it's is really basic. We had always been free. We had been living in Massachusetts for 150 years at this point. And we had always had our rights. There'd been chaos over in England. You know, we had the Glorious Revolution of 1688, and we had our problems here in Massachusetts during that time, but we had always been free. And we didn't want that to change. And all of a sudden, that was changing. The king and Parliament said that our legislature couldn't meet. And we had to meet at their prerogative, so we couldn't meet in Boston. It was spread around the state in an attempt to stop us from meeting. They said we couldn't have our public meetings, which we'd have been having again for over 100 years. This was how we did and conducted our civic business. They said we couldn't do it. They said we couldn't keep our arms. We couldn't keep our powder. The things that we possessed, not just the things, not just the material things, but these civic institutions that we had possessed and built up over time. As free men, we were told we couldn't have them anymore. We had always been free, and we meant to be free always. And they didn't mean that we should. 242 years ago today, there in Lexington and Concord, and they rode back to Boston. All right, when we come back after a quick timeout, Gabby Franco, host of Tips and Tactics, native of Venezuela, where there are many Venezuelans, may have once supported that glorious revolution there when Hugo Chavez took power, but they're not supporters anymore. Nicolas Maduro's approval rating, right around 20% in the country. He's arming his supporters. He's disarmed the civilians across the country, at least on paper. And now it looks like on the day of the mother of all protests, you've got Venezuelans who are crying out for freedom as well. Stick around. We'll be back with much more Cam and Company coming up right after this.
If 10 states made it a felony to read the New York Times, the media would run the story 24/7 until Congress fixed the assault on the First Amendment. But when 10 states criminalize the Second Amendment, the media says nothing. They don't report that honest, well-meaning people, nurses, stay-at-home moms, veterans, even a disaster relief worker, have been charged with felonies for simply having a lawfully owned firearm. Each was legally licensed to carry a firearm in their home state, but arrested and charged as criminals when safely carrying it through another, less free state. When states can deny one constitutional freedom, they can criminalize the entire Bill of Rights. On behalf of America's 100 million gun owners, we will fight until the full measure of our Second Amendment freedom is restored to every citizen in every corner of the land. We are the National Rifle Association of America, and we're freedom's safest place.
To every dishonest member of the failing American news media, let me explain why you've never been less trusted, less credible, or less respected. For decades, you ignored calls from millions of gun owners to just tell the truth. All you had to do was just get the facts right about our guns and our freedom. But you never even pretended to listen. Instead, you weaponized the First Amendment against the Second. And now the whole country sees you for the mockery we've always known. Your claim to the truth is as legitimate as a thief's. If the fate of individual freedom had rested in your hands, America would have fallen long ago. But Americans put their trust somewhere else. And now, in that place, stands the most trusted defender of individual freedom in American history. We're the National Rifle Association of America, and we're freedom's safest place.
It's great to be here to celebrate our freedom and those American values that we all hold dear.
The NRA has led the fight time and time again to protect our fundamental freedoms.
You're the tip of the spear, the ironclad face of tens of millions of patriots all over this country.
The NRA has not only protected our Second Amendment rights over the years, but it's also shown us all how to fight for the rest of our rights.
To the anti-gun left, the common enemy is the National Rifle Association, and you, its freedom-loving members.
Where others have talked, you fought. Where others have lost, you've won. We're the most fearsome grassroots army in the history of freedom.
American freedom is safer in this room than anywhere else on the planet.
All America lies at the end of the wilderness road. And our past is not a dead past, but still lives in us. Our forefathers had civilization inside themselves, the wild outside. We live in the civilization they created, but within us, the wilderness still lingers. What they dreamed, we live. And what they lived, we dream.
Welcome back to Cam and Company. Glad that you are with us here. Andrew Langer from the Institute for Liberty coming up a little bit later on in the hour. But in Caracas today, and really across Venezuela, there are protests in the streets. A Venezuelan student shot in the head by security forces has died. Nicolas Maduro telling his supporters that the hour of combat has arrived. This comes after arming 400,000 of his supporters, while 5 years ago his predecessor, Hugo Chavez, had declared civilian gun possession to be illegal. Gabby Franco, host of NRA's Tips and Tactics and a native of Venezuela, is with us on the program. Gabby, how are you today?
Very good, Cam. Thank you for having me today.
Absolutely. I'm glad you could be with us. Have you talked to your family in Venezuela lately? How are they feeling? Because it sure seems like from where we sit, things have taken some pretty ominous turns over the past few days.
It is actually, I talked to them, and it's actually scary because what Maduro, you can see that Maduro is just desperate. You can't cover the sun with a finger, and especially the people are just tired with the whole situation, not having food, no medicine, no bare necessities. And they're just out there just demanding for, you know, those things. And not only that, they want new elections. You know, as a free society, that should be just fine. Say, you know what, let's do a referendum, let's do this. But the government, which right now I think we can openly say that this is just he's just a dictator. Right now they are just basically saying that's what they are. You know, this is a dictatorship where they are just suppressing the population. You know, we all have different point of view. There are people who like him and there are people who don't. But what he's doing now by arming people they're following him, people that feel that they need to protect the revolution because they receive probably a bag of food once a month. That's the scary part of it, because he's empowering people that has no really true meaning of what they are looking forward to, more than keeping a little bit of the same misery.
Absolutely. And, you know, you talk about, and you've talked about this before when you've joined us, the setup in Venezuela where you've got these, and they're almost gangs, right, that have the protection of the Maduro regime, and they sort of enforce the regime line in the neighborhoods that they control. They in many cases, are responsible for the handouts of food. And if you don't support the regime, then you don't eat, right? Now, Maduro is doing what he can to make sure that those forces not only have the power to feed, but they've got the guns. And 5 years ago, it was 2012, when Hugo Chavez declared civilian gun possession to be illegal in Venezuela, Gabby, right? This was supposedly done as a crime-fighting measure. This was going to make Venezuela safer. I wonder how many people in Venezuela right now are regretting that action by the government 5 years ago.
Well, you have to take into consideration that this is a country where 95 or 90% of murders are not even solved. So how can you really tell which are are under name, you know, under the law, who are the criminals and who aren't. So the problem is that he is arming these people that he calls just the you know, el pueblo, like he said, obviously in Spanish, the people of Venezuela. But there's not really a saying who are responsible to have firearms. Not only that, he's just been doing it one-sided. It's not like here that, you know, everybody has that right, right? And people are responsible and accountable. That's what I want to say. People are accountable for what they do with those firearms. Over there in Venezuela, for what Maduro is doing, I'm going to tell you, those firearms, no doubt, are going to end up in the black market because he's just giving them away. There's no accountability of where the firearms are going to end up, where what people are going to do with those firearms. There's no guidelines that are going to say, okay, you know, you're going to keep them in the fort and you're going to have training and stuff like that. Obviously, that's not happening. So it's very dangerous what he's creating. And this could be in a couple of years. I wouldn't even want to call it, but, you know, this could be almost like a war zone where you have people who no accountability, you know, charging against other civilians who have no way to protect themselves at the same level.
Well, and, you know, you could say Caracas has been a war zone with the number of homicides that that city has seen. But this is a whole new dimension here, right? I mean, that's been primarily a drug-driven or robberies. It's not political violence. But the political violence in Venezuela now seems to be ramping up.
And the problem right now is that by him arming the people that are with him, he's just giving this, you know, individuals pretty much the okay to repress the other people who are against the government. And as you can see, these are just protests. People are unarmed, and which is, you know, scary when you in your own country cannot go outside and say, you know what, I disagree with this. Let's do, and they're legitimate requests. We are tired, you know, the Venezuelan people are tired of not being able to have a normal life, that going out and buy butter, milk, toilet paper, or just having a normal life that, you know, just the safety that you can go back home with your life, I mean, or your family, that you don't know if your family member is going to come back home. It's just, you just don't know. And by him arming these individuals, there's not even difference between the colectivos, which are gang members, and the militias that he's trying to arm. And don't get me wrong, there are people who are poor. Not everybody is a criminal. Not everybody is a bad people. But unfortunately, they are even going to suffer even more because they're going to be directly within reach of these gang members.
Absolutely. They're the most vulnerable. Although I would imagine, Gabby, a lot of people in Venezuela are feeling pretty vulnerable right now, because it's not as if Maduro enjoys a huge ton of support. What I've seen is that his approval ratings are around 20% or so. That's what's being reported. It may very well be that his approval rating is lower than that, but he is still, and his movement is still clinging to power. As you talk about, you talk about Maduro being a dictator. That's not how this all started out, right? I mean, Hugo Chavez was elected to office. Maduro was elected to office. There's a Congress in Venezuela. There's a Supreme Court in Venezuela, but the regime has slowly taken over all of these institutions with the exception of Congress. And then you had the Supreme Court a couple of weeks ago say, well, Congress is in contempt of our court orders. So we're taking over the legislative duties. You've got the opposition leader that's been told he can't run for office. He's been in prison for 15 years. I mean, this was a country that had democratic norms like we do in the United States, and they're disappearing by the day.
They are, and obviously they are. And if you look at the people who are on top, I mean, in power in Venezuela, they cannot even come to the United States because they have been... They are under investigation because of drug dealing and all that stuff. So if you think about it, they are really protecting their power as hard as much as they can, because where else are they gonna go? So this is goes beyond just power. That's their safe. That's Venezuela for all these individuals, like the vice president, by the way, which is under investigation. That is Venezuela, is their safety, right? So they are really doing all they can to maintain power, to keep the power. Chavez, when he got during the elections in 1997 or before the elections, he said that, you know, this was going to be a free country, that as soon as people wanted him to leave, he would have a referendum and he would leave if that's what the people wanted it. So obviously, by Chavez passing away, Maduro and all this crowd of individuals and politicians, what they're doing is using Chavez like a god, you know, and everything is about Chavez, mm-hmm. Even though he's dead, but they're using the same rhetoric. And if you pay attention, even Maduro talks exactly as Chavez. So this is just a psychological process they have worked and they have done for years. And what they have done is destroyed the hope for people to work, to get, you know, to have a future, because they just make people, you know, they just give just little things. And people get used to it. Some people get used to that, and that's what is very unfortunate. Now, by them disarming the society, right, by them having the grip of power, that is what makes this clearly a dictatorship.
So where does this end up, you think, Gabby? I mean, if you know, when you're looking and you're seeing what's going on here, you had 11 nations in Latin America yesterday say that Venezuela needed to have elections, but Maduro doesn't have to listen.
Of course.
What do you think happens? What does he do?
Unfortunately, like I said before, there's so much intake for Maduro, Cabello, which is the vice president, and all these people who are in power, because they are being, you know, looked at here in the United States as a drug, you know, they're drug dealers. So they want to stay in power as much as they can, even if they have to kill people. And that's a proof of it is what Maduro is just saying, arming just some side of the population. It's like, you are the ones who are worth, the other ones are not. He is actually giving the okay to kill people. So where this is going to go, to tell the truth, I would say this is not going to go right now nowhere, because the vast majority right now, who are even people who like Chavez, they are not eating more than the people who don't like Chavez. So they are pretty much in the same packed, like they are tired, but because they are suppressed by the government, because the government is having that strong grip, it makes the situation even more difficult. So this is going to be, if you look at it, like North Korea, you know, even Cuba, this is Venezuela, is going to end up pretty much like that. And people ask me, but, you know, people can leave the country, it's not like an island like Cuba. Well, not so much. They are actually restricting the passports. Like right now, for me to get a passport, oh my God, it takes forever. So that's what they're doing. They're keeping people in or keeping people out. So they are isolating the community. Little by little, they have been, you know, taking the news, the media. The media is pretty much owned by the government. Internet is limited. It's very hard. They have destroyed the small businesses. So this, even if Maduro, you know, if they are out of, you know, they're not in power anymore, it's going to take a ton of years, a lot of years, to try to get back to where we were. And I was talking to Venezuelans, my friends, and one thing that everybody says is that we didn't realize how good we had it. You know, as people don't realize what they have, they take it for granted.
Unfortunately, you're right, Gabby. And listen, I think I speak for the audience here. My heart just aches with what's going on down there. I know you've got a lot of friends down there. You've got family in Venezuela. And it is, you know, we've got a lot of dangerous places in the world these days, but Venezuela is certainly one of them. And I hope that there is a peaceful resolution. I hope that there is a happy ending, as you say. Venezuela, even if Maduro were to step down tomorrow, you know, Venezuela's got a long road ahead of it. But I certainly hope things don't continue to get worse. Gabby, thank you so much for joining us today. I look forward to seeing you very soon, and hopefully we'll be able to have you back on again before long.
Thank you for having me, Cam. I really enjoyed it. And
absolutely.
Thank you for on Venezuela's, you know, everybody, thank you for being on top of this and, you know, telling the U.S. to the world, what's going on.
Well, thank you, Gabby. Gabby Franco joining us, host of NRA Tips and Tactics. Native of Venezuela, and probably not a friend of the Maduro regime. I bet the regime is not happy with Gabby here in the United States. You know, Maduro is blaming all of this on the United States. Yeah, all of the economic problems that Venezuela is facing, it's not because this oil-dependent country ended up blowing through all of its revenues, providing this, you know, expansive social net when oil was $100 a barrel. And now that oil is $50 a barrel, can't afford to do this anymore. It's not their own mistakes. It could never be the mistakes of the regime. It could never be that the Glorious Revolution made a mistake. No, it has to be that there's a conspiracy, a capitalist conspiracy. And of course, the United States is at the heart of that capitalist conspiracy. In fact, Maduro yesterday said that the protests in Venezuela today, all staged by the United States as part of a coup attempt, that the, he says the U.S. has given the green light to a coup there, and all of this that's going on is, it's all because of the U.S. government. Doesn't matter if it was the Trump government or the Obama administration or the Clinton administration. It doesn't matter who it would have been. We're just the scapegoat for the failures of this regime. And again, as the protests continue in Caracas, the violence right now reported as quote unquote sporadic, meaning that it is happening. The gangs are out. The pro-government gangs are out there in force. At least one individual shot and killed. The Miami Herald reporting the colectivos, the pro-government gangs, trying to keep the protesters from gathering there in Caracas as the protesters try to mount what they call the mother of all protests against Nicolas Maduro and the Maduro regime. All right, when we return, Andrew Langer from the Institute for Liberty joins us talking about a free election here in the United States. It was hotly contested, but it was a free and fair election. Georgia's 6th congressional district last night did not elect John Ossoff, the Democrat, to Congress, much to the disappointment of Alyssa Milano and a lot of other celebrities out there. We'll break down that election. We'll talk about the upcoming runoff with Andrew Langer. So stick around. There's more Cam and Company coming up next. Jana Waller, the host of Skullbound TV, is with us on the show. I thought about you when I saw this story last week, and I should have known that there's more than one hunter in Montana who's gone looking for dinosaur bones, because you yourself have spent some time not looking for elk or bear in Montana, but looking for creatures long gone. This is so cool.
I have. So last summer, I had the opportunity to go on my very first dino dig. We went with Eric Siegfried, who is the owner of Onyx Maps here in Missoula, Montana. His mom has a piece of property over in eastern Montana that is known for dinosaur bones. And we spent 2.5 days getting all muddied, getting all dirtied, and just hunting for bones, teeth, claws, you name it. And we had a lot of success. We found, Jimmy actually found a big Triceratops rib bone. We found lots of small teeth and claws, part of a T-Rex tooth. I found a lot of Hadrosaur teeth and Triceratops, smaller bones, but we had such a blast. And it's addicting like any other form of hunting.
Well, and now that you know that David Bratt, who 7 years ago discovered this fossil that turns out to be a previously undiscovered species. I mean, he's had this named after him now, Nacogdoches bradtii. We could have Janet, we could have the Skullboundosaurus if you keep hunting for dinosaurs one day.
Oh, hey, goals. Hashtag goals. That's all I have to say. I mean, wouldn't that be such a trip? I can't imagine, you know, uncovering, because there are a lot of small pieces of stuff we didn't even know, you know, what they belong to. I cannot imagine discovering a brand new species of dinosaurs. But I saw the same article and all hashtag goals, man.
But, you know, it's so cool. And I know that's not why David Bratt was out there. He was out there looking for an elk when he just, you know, happened to see this and thought, huh, this is really interesting. But here's the thing, Jenna, unless you're out there, right, unless you're out in the field, you have no chance of there's no chance you're going to discover a new species of dinosaur sitting on your couch in your living room. There's just no way.
Exactly. That's half the beauty of hunting right there, is never knowing what you're going to see, never knowing what you're going to find. Every hunter I know is constantly kind of on the lookout for deer, elk sheds that have dropped, arrowheads. I mean, I went on an elk hunt in Oregon a few years ago, and I did not notch that tag, but I found a 4-inch obsidian spear tip that's been dated by two arrowhead experts to be 6,000 or so years old. That was worth the hunt alone for me. I mean, most hunters I know were scroungers, and you're right. If you're not out there, you're not exploring and you know, immersing yourself in that type of environment, you're missing out.
Okay, so I got to tell you, it would have been really cool to fill that tag, but, you know, to hold something in your hand, I mean, as a hunter yourself, to hold that in your hand, something that's 6,000 years old, and to feel that bond, because the person who crafted that spearhead 6,000 years ago, they went out into the field, they were hunting, this was a part of their life. I mean, where else do you find a connection throughout thousands of years of human history like that, Jana?
I've always said that. I've always said that hunting is such a primitive connection to our planet, to the way everyone used to live off the land. And when I found that, I felt a surge of energy. Like that was, I think, 4 years ago. I still talk about that on a monthly basis. I show everyone who comes over. It's probably my most prized possession I've ever found. I found lots of small arrowheads and broken pieces and pottery and such, but that obsidian piece to me is, you know, I'll never ever forget that moment. I reached down. There was actually just a tip of it in the sand, and I reached down to pick it up, and just, I was elated. And you're right, that was crafted by another hunter 6,000 years ago. From what I had gathered from the other experts, arrowhead experts, it had never been shot, because obsidian was the sharpest material to use at the time, but it would have been exploded on target. So whether it fell out of his satchel or he left it behind, it was seriously one of the coolest gifts I've ever found.
Welcome back to Cam and Company. Glad you've joined us here. We've got Rhonda Ezell joining us from Chicago Guns Matter next hour. A little bit of breaking news out of D.C., or out of New York City, rather. Fox issuing the following statement just a short time ago. After a thorough and careful review of the allegations, the company and Bill O'Reilly have agreed that Bill O'Reilly will not be returning to the Fox News channel. So Bill O'Reilly out at Fox News. Andrew Langer in at Cam and Company, joining us on the program right now. Andrew _ Langer. Andrew, how are you, sir?
I am great and shocked by this news.
I'm sorry to lay that on you as we just come back from break. I'm a little surprised by that as well, but I guess there have been hints of this. You know, Matt Drudge kind of hinted this a couple of days ago, and since then we've seen additional reporting that this was the direction that Fox wanted to go.
Well, time for our good friend Scotty Hughes to get her show on Fox.
Well, now the great reshuffling begins, right? And now you have a valuable spot opening up. I won't necessarily say it'll be at 9, because I think they might be moving some folks around. I think there are rumors out there unsubstantiated. I have no inside knowledge of this, but rumors that Tucker Carlson would move to take Bill O'Reilly's spot. But I'm sure that Fox is going to be inundated with air checks and recommendations on who would be perfect for that spot.
Yes.
Yeah. Not me, though. I don't want to leave my pigs or my family or my goats or anything else. I am happy right here in Farmville.
Yes, you and me both. I don't want to leave Williamsburg anytime soon.
All right, let's talk about what's going on in Georgia because, Andrew, Alyssa Milano tweeted she felt like she was going to puke last night. I mean, settled in. Let's all watch. Let's all watch the election results come in. She was so happy. It was going to be a glorious evening. John Ossoff was going to sweep to victory. He's going to get over 50% of the vote. I mean, he had what, a 4-1 spinning advantage over other Republicans in there, or over any Republican candidate in the field. He had celebrities who were driving people to the polls. He had a lot of national attention, and all he had to do was crack 50% plus one vote, Andrew, and he would be the next member of Congress, and we're going to a runoff. Didn't happen.
Here's the funny thing. What I found hysterical, and we had some clips on our podcast this morning, you know, he is on record saying that it was a stunning achievement. And I'm trying to figure out what that was. So, you know, if you figure Hillary Clinton got about, you know, five, I think it was roughly 48% of the vote, maybe a little bit less. And he essentially got about a percentage point more than Hillary Clinton in an environment in which, you know, you had Donald Trump not being as popular as he might be elsewhere. And so to spend $8 million to essentially achieve an extra percentage point, I'm trying to figure out why. And obviously we all know that this is spin. It's massive spin. There's massive disappointment behind the scenes. But to come out there and call it a stunning achievement is, you know, that to me is a stunning achievement in and of itself. I mean, that is, it represents a sort of bizarre surreality in which the hard left currently lives.
So here's the thing, and I know that Don Lemon compared John Ossoff to Barack Obama last night, which is, I think, okay, Don. I don't know if you saw the clip on CNN where he was asked, and it was, I think, Allison Camerota who asked John Ossoff, so is it true you can't vote for yourself today? Just kind of left it open like that, right? Because he doesn't live in the district. And he said, look, I grew up in the district. My parents live there. You know, my girlfriend's at Emory, and I'm supporting her. And so I just have about 10 minutes outside of the district, and I'll be back. Would not say, yeah, I don't live in the district. She asked him again, like, okay, so just specifically here, just to make sure, you don't live in the district, right? Well, I'm supporting my girlfriend. And it was one of those really couched answers, Andrew. It wasn't authentic. You know, you could tell that this was what a consultant had told him to say. And yeah. I'm sure that didn't impact the Donald Trump haters and the members of the resistance. They could have cared less. But in this district, that's not going to get you enough votes to win, right? No. So you can be that, you know, representative of the resistance, and you can get all of the love and adulation from celebrities. But in a district that leans red, you've also got to be able to reach beyond the base. And I don't know that John Ossoff was able to do that any more than Thompson in the Kansas special election was able to do that. This, you know, look, we still live in a very divided electorate, and that's an issue for both Republican and Democratic candidates.
Well, and I think it really represents in an environment in which, and in a district in which Donald Trump was not decidedly popular, right? In a district that has had shifting demographics, the fact is that I think the maximum you're going to see is about 46, 47, 48% of the electorate, depending on who the Republican is who's running against him. We've got Karen Handel, she's got a lot of experience in running. She's run for a lot of different offices. She's got the name ID. And no, she's not, you know, she's not Newt Gingrich and she's not Tom Price. She's going to be her own person. Listen, here's what it comes back to for me, right? You can ask the questions of John Ossoff about whether or not he lives in the district. And, you know, to be clear, I mean, obviously we know what the Constitution says, and my good friend Dan Bongino ran in Maryland's 6th congressional district and didn't actually live there. But on the other hand, here's what I want to focus on with this guy, John Ossoff. Do you know who he worked for when he worked up on Capitol Hill?
Remind me.
He worked for Hank Johnson.
Oh,
and not
that's
only
right.
did he work for Hank Johnson, but he was Hank Johnson's senior legislative affairs person when Hank Johnson had that infamous tete-a-tete with an admiral over whether or not Guam was going to tip over if it became overpopulated or if the Navy expanded its base there. And this guy, not only did he not distance himself from Hank Johnson when this happened, but he turned around and weeks later ran Hank Johnson's reelection campaign. So the question I want to ask him is not, you know, we can ask him whether or not he lives in the district. I want to ask him whether or not he's the person who briefed Hank Johnson about Guam's potential to be tipped over, and whether or not he agreed with his boss. And if he didn't agree with his boss, how come he ran his reelection campaign right afterward?
I would love to find out the answer to that. and look, here's the thing. Maybe it is a big deal to voters. Maybe it's not a big deal to voters. But the way that you address that, because it is going to be, I think, an issue for some voters. But the way you address an issue like that is to be upfront about it, right? To say, yeah, I live outside the district. And here was the thing, like the excuse that he offered. He was like, well, you know, I wanted to be close to my girlfriend, but I'm only a mile and a half outside of the district. Like, those two things seem like really weak sauce, Andrew. Like, okay, well, so if you want to be close to your girlfriend, can you not be like a mile and a half further away from your girlfriend? She can live in the district. Like,
why don't you get your girlfriend to move into the district? Right, I mean, right. You know, let's be clear here. But the reality, right, Cam, is it's not just that he lives outside the district, right? Because again, you look at Maryland and Maryland's so convoluted, who the heck knows where people are. But the reality is, he lives outside the district. He hasn't lived in the district for a very long time, and almost all, I think something on the order of 99% of his money came from outside the district. Those two things combined together, that has a habit of turning people off. And remember, politics is a game of addition and multiplication, not division and subtraction. You want to give people a reason to vote for you. You don't want to give them a reason to vote against you. And this is a reason for people to vote against the guy, because he's got all of it. He's an outsider with outside money. And we folks don't want to be dictated to by folks on either coast.
So speaking of outside money, I don't know if you saw the story in the Richmond Times-Dispatch today, but Tom Perriello, one of the Democratic candidates for governor, raking in the cash, Andrew, but it's coming in from out of state, and it's coming in from just a handful of individuals, including George Soros, who has given Perriello's campaign something like $350,000. Soros's kids have contributed. Richmond.com, Jeff Shapiro says more than half of the $2.2 million that Perriello has raised since declaring in January comes from four donors, three individuals in a foundation that he helped start. Most have New York addresses. That to me, I think, as you say, is an alarm bell. For any politician right now, if your support is coming from outside of your district, if there's not evidence of real grassroots enthusiasm for your campaign in terms of contributions, in terms of volunteers, that is, I think, going to raise the hackles of a lot of voters.
Well, it really gets down to this, right? I mean, Perriello's playing a very interesting game. By running as a hard left Democrat in Virginia, it's obvious he's going for the disaffected Northern Virginia Democratic voters. I mean, you know, essentially everybody who loved Barack Obama and stayed in D.C. after Barack Obama's departure, that's what he's going for. Plus, you know, as I think you and I have talked about, folks down in the Hampton Roads area and folks in the Richmond area. But the reality is, it becomes very hard for Perriello to pivot. Should he wind up achieving the nomination, it's very hard for him to pivot outside of those areas. And especially if you get someone who is not a traditional ideologue like Ed Gillespie. I mean, don't get me wrong, I think Ed Gillespie is a committed constitutional conservative, but Ed's not an ideologue. Ed's a smart guy. who is pragmatic in many, many ways, you know, it's going to be very hard for a guy like Perriello to, again, build that coalition beyond the hardcore base for him to win.
Talking again with Andrew Langer from the Institute for Liberty, Andrew_Langer on Twitter. Andrew, unfortunately, we are almost out of time, so I will let you know the latest here. Gabriel Sherman, National Affairs Editor at New York Magazine, says, according to sources at Fox, Tucker Carlson at 8 p.m., and the 5 moves to 9 p.m. starting next Monday, the 24th.
And then you and me taking over the 5
o'clock. Oh, the 2. I'm kind of disappointed that they didn't move the 5 to 8 o'clock and renamed it the Ocho. We could have actually had the Ocho.
I like that. The Ocho. I love it. All right, man. Have a good one.
All right, buddy. You too. Andrew Langer with us on the program. Stick around. Hour 2 of Cam and Company is on the way. Rhonda Ezell with Chicago Guns Matter going to join us. Seton Motley from Less Government as well. Plus more of the day's top Second Amendment news and information from all around the country. It's all coming up after a quick timeout. We'll be right back here on Cam and Company. So we were talking a little bit during the break. You grew up around guns. You grew up in a gun family, right?
I did.
Always been important to you?
Very much so. Always been very much steeped in tradition, and I have guns that have been passed down, and it was always something that I did from the time that I was big enough to keep up with the adults in the woods, and I've done the best that I can to pass that along to my daughters. It's surprising as to how much they enjoy something that would be, you know, stereotyped as more of a man thing.
Right. I think those stereotypes, though, are being blown away. I mean, we're just listening during the break to, like, Janna Waller.
I was blown away with what she was saying. It was so well said.
Right.
And in the 20 seconds that she had to cram it into.
But there are. I mean, there are so many voices, like, you know, Christy Titus, Janna. I mean, really, just, you know, you could go down the list. And you could watch Outdoor Channel, you watch Sportsman Channel, and you see these folks. Heck, you know, I'll tell you what, even this past fall, when I was in Virginia, stopping in my local deer check-in station. I mean, it wasn't 50-50 men and women.
Sure,
but...
and my statement in no way was meant to be even slightly chauvinistic. I'm looking at my daughters who love to play with dolls and who love to do all this girly stuff, and that will have just as much fun doing complete girly stuff with mom all day, but will then turn around and come and be my bird dogs in the woods while we try to kick up partridge and woodcock, you know.
So. I think that's awesome. I think it's fantastic. And so... You know, the importance of passing this on, is this one of the reasons why you've gotten involved with NRA Country to help others do that and to maintain these traditions?
I've been a lifetime member of NRA since I was old enough to be one, you know. And it's something that I very strongly believe in. I think it's one of the most fundamentally important amendments in our documents that create this amazing country, and regardless of whether we're 200, however many hundreds of years we are away from when it started, they still apply.
Absolutely.
And they're not antiquated, and it's important, and I'm not willing to let that freedom go.
Well, as somebody who, you know, makes a living exercising this First Amendment right, you know, all these rights are important.
Even though it can get me in trouble.
Well, Listen, nobody ever said the First Amendment, you know. Yes, you've got your freedom
thing.
Of speech, right?
That's
but you've also got
the
freedom to
freedom,
respond.
Yeah.
Exactly. And in a free society, you do have disagreements, you do have dissent, but everybody gets to speak their piece, everybody gets to speak their mind. It's when we start trying to shut people up and saying, okay, you're not allowed to say what you think. You're not allowed to feel what you feel. That's when I think we really get in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I would much rather have the chaotic, what was it Jefferson said, the turbulent sea of public opinion. I'd much rather have that than the, you know, docile waters of authoritarianism where you can only speak the pre-approved thoughts.
That's what's amazing is that, you know, opinions are all different, and in a pool, a bunch of different opinions come up with great ideas.
Right. And now with Donald Trump becoming president, all of a sudden, dissent is patriotic again, right? As opposed to the last 8 years where you were supposed to sort of toe the party line.
I find myself standing proudly in that basket of deplorables.
Hour 2 of Cam and Company. It starts right now here on Sirius XM Patriot 125, NRA TV, and more. Rodney Zell with Chicago Guns Matter. Join us in just a little bit. Seton Motley of Less Government coming up on the program as well. You know, we're going to be talking with Rhonda about gun ranges in Chicago. Well, actually, the lack of gun ranges in Chicago, because the city of Chicago has thwarted any attempt to open up a range. They've been told by the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals not once but twice to get their act together. Hopefully the third time is going to be the charm, but we'll see what happens with the latest rules and regulations for proposed gun ranges. But look, this is part and parcel of the quote-unquote gun safety movement right now. You've got people who are advocating, saying they're advocates of gun safety, who want to make it as hard as possible for people to actually get education and training, go to the range and practice. They don't want to see that happen, but they call themselves gun safety advocates. Latest example of this in New Hampshire, the Concord Monitor reporting that Monday night there was a city council meeting in Warner, in Warner, New Hampshire, about a gun range that wants to open up, indoor range. And again, they're throwing like every roadblock that they could possibly think of at this range. So they decided on Monday night that, this range actually has the potential for regional impact. So it's not just going to be us who's going to get involved here. Now we're going to get the town of Hopkinton, as well as the Central New Hampshire Regional Planning Commission. They've all got to get involved here and sign off on this range opening up, which gives the opponents of the range another opportunity to express why they think the range should not, in fact, be allowed to exist. Concord Monitor says the board voted after dozens of town officials, residents from Warner, Hopkinton, even Concord and Weir spoke. Supporters arguing the project would provide a much-needed resource to the area. Kimberly Edelman, who is a select board member in Warner, New Hampshire, said there are a lot of us who shoot our guns outside right now. And we piss off our neighbors, we scare our dogs, we scare the horses. We need an indoor solution somewhere in Warner. So look, you don't want people complaining about, you know, noise? Okay, well, give us a place to shoot. We've got somebody who wants to open up a range. Let's make it happen. Eric Miller, who is the owner of Dragonfly Holdings, they're the company that wants to actually open up this range. He said, look, you're not going to hear anything. Even from outside the building, you're not going to hear anything. We're designing the facility, even the lanes for rifles. They're going to be the loudest of the guns that are fired there. They're going to be insulated by other lanes. It's going to have 16 shooting lanes. Range could hold about 22 people at full capacity. And the Concord Monitor says those who oppose the project were concerned the range would be unsafe, would negatively impact local businesses, when it would be too close to the Hopkinton town line. I don't know why that's an issue. As well as schools. So there's one company, MadgeTech. And their representative, Paul Alfano, was there at the planning board meeting on Monday night. He said, look, we're hoping to expand, but it's going to be hard if there's a range nearby. Really? I would imagine that might be a selling point for some of your employees. He said that his other client, who owns a house 318 feet away from the proposed site, has small children, would be concerned about the closeness of the range. He said, you're not going to be able to tell children to stay 318 feet away from the property. They could be running right up to the property line. Now, again, this is an indoor range that we're talking about. This is an indoor, you should be no more concerned about your kid running up to the door of this establishment than the door of the McDonald's or the door of the dentist's office, or any other business there. But that's the concern. Justin Carroll lives about 300 feet from the proposed site of the range. He says he has two daughters under the age of five and two dogs who frequently escape from his property. He said, I'm worried that if one of them runs towards the range, someone might use their gun to defend themselves. I like to shoot and go to the gun range, but I'm not comfortable with one being a stone's throw from my home. I have to tell you, in 13 years of doing this program, I have never run across that story of a individual, a patron of a range, walking out of the range. All of a sudden, a dog runs up, and the patron, in fear of their life, shoots the dog. I have never, ever seen that happen. I would think that Justin Carroll probably should be more concerned about the dogs getting loose and being hit by a car, because there's going to be a lot more cars driving by his house than there are going to be patrons to the indoor gun range. But that's the fear, right? That's the fear of the unknown. And I don't know that that fear was alleviated, honestly. Concord Monitor says several residents from the nearby town of Hopkinton concerned that the project had not been considered one of regional impact in the first place. After all, the range is going to be about 2/5 of a mile away from the town line, and almost, they say, 2 miles from the Hopkinton Middle/High School. Almost 2 miles. But apparently that's too close for the indoor range to be located 2 miles away from a Middle/High School. Renee Adams, who was one of those who spoke, said the road is frequented by the school's running teams. Again, the concern, I would think, would be maybe with the traffic on those roads that the running teams run on, as opposed to the patrons of an indoor range there in New Hampshire. But I don't know that any member of the planning board actually said anything like that. And again, the delay granted, more roadblocks put up for the individuals who want to open up this range by the combination of the not in my backyard crowd and the quote unquote gun safety advocates who believe that gun safety means you just don't own a gun. Boy, I hope one day I can report on a indoor range opening up here in Farmville, Virginia, and the debate in the city council chambers. I think, by the way, there wouldn't be much debate. We could use an indoor range here in Farmville, and I hope that in Warner, New Hampshire, they get one as well. Also in Indiana, so that's out of New Hampshire, attacks on ranges. In Indiana, you had this attack, which has since been pulled back, it should be noted. Sounds like local lawmakers heard from a lot of constituents in LaPorte County, Indiana, because someone floated out the idea that we should make it illegal in the county to shoot within 1,000 feet of a house. Mm-hmm. Which would have, in essence, ended sports shooting, plinking, hunting in LaPorte County, Indiana. This was introduced. And this would have affected ranges, too. It's not like this just would have been like in your backyard, you got to be 1,000 feet away from your home. Mm-mm. Ranges would have been affected, including the range for police in LaPorte County. Indiana State Police Firearms Instructor Tim McCormick said, we have an officer returning for duty. He's coming back to our department after pursuing other interests for a while. We're going to be doing all of his training that he missed out on last year. He says, we're going to try to cram it all in one day because we don't know if we're going to be able to use the range. After hearing again from folks like Mr. McCormick and residents there, the county officials, okay, this was premature. This was getting ahead of ourselves. Democrat Commissioner Vidya Kora said the board had good intentions when proposing the ordinance. Oh, that's good. And I mean, it's great to have good intentions. I would hope that anything offered by a lawmaker is offered with good intention. I would hope that if we have lawmakers out there introducing bills specifically, well, my intent is to cause irreparable harm to the community. I would hope that they would get voted out of office relatively quickly. So, yeah, well, it was meant with good intentions. Okay. Cora said there were a few complaints about somebody discharging their firearms in the unincorporated areas and subdivisions, which caused some consternation. There weren't any reports about anybody being unsafe. There weren't any reports about actual problems. Someone just didn't like the sound of their neighbor shooting on the weekends and said, we should do something about this. And again, the first response of at least one lawmaker there in LaPorte County, Indiana was, yeah, we should do something. Let's ban it. Right? As the first response, Vijay Kora says the proposal was premature and his Republican counterparts agree. Now, WSBT doesn't actually quote Vijay Kora as saying that the proposal was premature. I would love to know if that's the word that he actually used, premature. Because if so, you could not be more wrong, Commissioner. Because there will never be an appropriate time to actually introduce an ordinance that would ban private property owners from safely shooting on their property. Never would there be a time when that would not be premature or inappropriate. Inappropriate would have been a better word to use. Not premature. Because it'll never be ripe. Commissioner Michael Gonder released a statement saying, quote, we will not advance additional local restrictions on the gun rights enshrined in the Second Amendment of our Constitution. Okay, that's better. That's better. Cora says the Board of Commissioners will go back to the drawing board to find a, quote, better solution. So, again, it's not like they're saying, well, you know, listen, you live in the country. You've got neighbors who are gun owners. If they're shooting safely, okay. Maybe, now see, listen, if the concern is the noise, if the concern is the noise, then maybe these county commissioners in LaPorte County, Indiana, need to author a resolution in support of the Hearing Protection Act so that the gun owners in LaPorte County could have easier access to suppressors, which would not eliminate the sound, but would reduce the sound, and maybe the complaining neighbors wouldn't be so bothered, wouldn't have as much of a reason to complain. Maybe if they're going back to the drawing board, maybe they could draw up a resolution along those lines. But LaPorte County, Indiana, Warner, New Hampshire, not exactly anti-gun hotbeds, right? I mean, this isn't San Francisco we're talking about. It's not Washington, D.C. But you are still seeing attempts to infringe on the right to keep and bear arms and to train and use your firearms safely and responsibly. No matter where we live, our rights are being threatened right now. And it's up to us to get involved, like Rhonda Ezell, who has been involved for years in the Second Amendment fight in Chicago. And when Rhonda got started in this fight, she didn't really have a Second Amendment right in Chicago. Chicago had banned handguns. That ban had been on the books for decades. There was no right to carry in Illinois. Rhonda Ezell was told, living in the Windy City, you don't have a right to keep and bear arms. And Rhonda said, yeah, I do. And she's been fighting for years to get the city of Chicago to actually recognize and acknowledge this is a right that we're talking about. This isn't a privilege. This isn't something that you dole out to residents as a reward for being extra good people. No, this is a right that we possess as Americans. And Rhonda in Chicago has the exact same right to keep and bear arms that I do in Farmville, Virginia? Or as Cameron Gray in Alexandria? Or as the 80,000 gun owners in Atlanta next week? It's the same right for all of us. It's just that we have some jurisdictions out there around the country and some politicians out there around the country who still refuse to acknowledge this. We'll talk with Rhonda coming up in just a couple of minutes about the possibility of Chicago maybe starting to, if not see the light, at least finally pay attention to what courts have been telling them and demanding of city officials. Stick around. We've got more Cam and Company coming up right after this. You know, in terms of federal legislation, because in the first 100 days, Donald Trump has, you know, look, he's nominated a Supreme Court justice in the mold of Antonin Scalia. He has undone a lot of the Obama-era regulations. Congress helped do that through the Congressional Review Act. But in terms of, you know, right to carry reciprocity, in terms of Hearing Protection Act, that's legislation that has to go through Congress before the president can sign it. And Congress obviously has a lot on their plate right now with health care, tax reform. How do we make sure that lawmakers understand that these are issues that we don't want on the back burner, that we want these issues to get their hearings, to get their votes, and hopefully to get to Donald Trump's desk?
Well, that's a great question, and it's a very real challenge. And it's not like tomorrow, you know, Congress is going to wake up and say, look, this needs to be our number one priority. It's up to all of us to stay engaged and to let them know that it is our priority, that we expect the Second Amendment and we expect self-defense not just to be protected but to be expanded upon based on the restrictions that have been put in the past. There is a lot of work to do. The Hearing Protection Act is a no-brainer. A national right to carry reciprocity is years overdue. But now's the time for all of us to engage. We have to fight like this is a campaign, just like we did this past November, all year in 2016, when we fought for knowing what was at stake in November. We need to bring the same energy, the same commitment, and the same determination to see Congress pass these pieces of legislation. We still have some challenges. The wills of Congress and government move slowly on a good day. You've seen the Democrats in the Senate try to undermine this president's agenda every step of the way. They're certainly not looking to make it any easier. You've seen Michael Bloomberg commit $25 million to try to undermine right to carry reciprocity. So we face challenges, but we also it's also we the people, and we the people need to make our voices heard. We need to weigh in with our senators. We need to weigh in with our members of Congress and do exactly what you said. Make sure that this is a priority. Make sure they understand how important and that life and death is what's at stake in some of these pieces of legislation. When you start talking about right to carry reciprocity, you're talking about us being, you know, the defenders of our own personal safety and our own lives. So this is very important, but working together, we can keep the momentum going and build some momentum and get these things through and get them on the president's desk where he's already committed to signing them.
It's great to be here to celebrate our freedom and those American values that we all hold dear.
The NRA has led the fight time and time again to protect our fundamental freedoms.
You're the tip of the spear, the ironclad face of tens of millions of patriots all over this country.
The NRA has not only protected our Second Amendment rights over the years, but it's also shown us all how to fight for the rest of our rights.
To the anti-gun left, the common enemy is the National Rifle Association and you, its freedom-loving members.
Where others have talked, you fought. Where others have lost, you've won. We're the most fearsome grassroots army in the history of freedom.
American freedom is safer in this room than anywhere else on the planet.
Nearly all our projects are going to conflict with the natural world, if only in their absurd futility. Their false sense of importance, gravity, and urgency in the face of our upcoming deaths. Only one project embraces death as the absolute that it is. Only one project confronts the absurdity by its very nature. The anti-hunters have imposed a false order on their lives. based on a misconceived perception of the world. Death is evil, they believe. And so the purveyor of death must also be evil. But the world is its own, and it will have itself back.
Welcome back to Cam and Company, your first source for Second Amendment news and information. Still to come, Stephen Motley from Less Government, but right now Rhonda Ezell with Chicago Guns Matter is with us on the program. You can find her on Twitter at Ms_Ezell. Rhonda, how you doing today?
I'm doing fine, Cam. How are you?
I am great. Thank you very much for coming on the program. And I think a cautious congratulations to you. With the word that the city of Chicago, I've seen the headlines here, reluctant aldermen relax rules governing shooting ranges. I say a cautious congratulations because you've been here before, Rhonda. I mean, you've seen the Chicago City Council supposedly revise their rules.
Yes, I saw that. And like others, there were other headlines as things that were said that Chicago could allow or step closer to easing. I mean, it's amazing how they want to spin this topic.
Because
it's unfortunate.
Well, and because the courts have said, no, it's not a matter of you could allow this to happen or you could ease the possibility of a range. No, the courts have said, City of Chicago, you got to get your act together here. You're violating people's constitutional rights by not allowing a range to open. You have to allow for a range to open up in the city of Chicago.
Exactly. And the thing about it is the city of Chicago tends to want to miseducate the people here by telling them these things as if the mayor and the aldermen are allowing these things for them. You know, it's unfortunate that they don't respect the Seventh Circuit Court decision. The city of Chicago has to understand you have lost federal lawsuits, plenty of them, to the Second Amendment movement. This is another one. You are complying with federal judgments. There's no in-betweens here. And they need to understand that. So the aldermen, they don't understand. They feel they're moving in the wrong direction. How could you possibly be moving in the wrong direction by following the law?
Yeah. Well, you know, and listen, all you got to do is to see some of the quotes. Chicago Sun-Times had quoted, Alderwoman Michelle Smith, who said, quote, "I appreciate the strength of the gun lobby and the gun laws in this country, but I don't understand why our previous attempt to restrict the locations of shooting ranges is being eliminated, particularly the limitation on schools, daycare, liquor, libraries, museums, and hospitals." As if, by the way, the restriction was, well, you can't have a gun range in a liquor store or a daycare. No, it was they had set it up in such a way, Rhonda, that what you had to be like 500 feet away from any one of these items, a school, a daycare, liquor store, library, museum, hospital. And basically there was about, what, 2% of the land area in the city of Chicago that theoretically was open for a range?
If that much. That was the intended purposes, so that no one would ever possibly be able to have the opportunity to even build a range. But at the end of the day, when the city of Chicago know that they have been found unconstitutional in every avenue that they've tried to present, they have no other choice. We have 2,144,057 firearm owner identification card holders in the state of Illinois, as well as 229,732,000 concealed carry license holders. Those people need somewhere to go. And I don't know the number exactly on how many are in the city of Chicago, but those people have a constitutional right. And that was the purpose of taking the city of Chicago to court to make sure that we in the city of Chicago had that fundamental right to exercise. And the city needs to respect that. There's no other way around it.
So one of the new provisions that the city's put in place, Rhonda, so now theoretically you could open up a gun range in a place zoned for business, commercial, manufacturing districts, but you've got to get a special use permit from the Zoning Board of Appeals. That means you got to notify surrounding residents. There's going to be a public hearing. And this, I think, is where, again, if the city doesn't really want to play ball and recognize your right to keep and bear arms, this is where the trouble comes in, right? Because what happens if they just simply deny every one of these special use permits? And, again, the net result is no ranges get to open up.
When they'll be taken right back to court and they'll definitely lose again.
I'm glad to hear you say that.
I don't understand why they would attempt to keep having the taxpayers pay for these losing battles that they keep want to find themselves in. But this is another example of how the city of Chicago and our mayor tends to believe that he basically owns this place. It doesn't make sense, but yet he walks around every day with protection, with people carrying firearms for the safety of his life, as if his life is more important than the rest of ours. Doesn't make any sense.
No, it does not. But listen, you know what? The people of Chicago who can look up to you, can look up to the late Otis McDonald, and so many other folks across the state of Illinois and there in the Chicago area who are continuing to fight for the right to keep and bear arms. I hope that you continue to grow your support. And with Chicago Guns Matter, I got to tell you, Rhonda, you are really making a difference there, and this organization is making a difference. I saw a column in the Chicago Sun-Times the other day by Laura Washington, who starts her column. She says, "I write often harshly about the people of the gun. I harbor a dim view of Second Amendment advocates." And yet she wrote a glowing profile of a woman, Alfreda Keith Keller, who is a part of Chicago Guns Matter. And I thought this was amazing, the outreach that you all are able to accomplish there in Chicago.
Yes. Ms. Keller, she's a nice person, and Laura did a great write-up. And what we're doing here at Chicago Guns Matter is we want to reach the urban community, the black community, and educate everyone about their rights, because no one is actually going to do that. So what we're trying to do here is, once again, put the faces to the cases. Let the people understand who's doing this and who's behind it and what we're trying to accomplish here. And get this point across. Ms. Keller actually is not with Chicago Guns Matter.
She's
a friend of Chicago Guns Matter. But, you know, we were together, me and Ms. Keller, at IGO as well. So, yes, that was a good look. And that was a great write-up, because we don't often get the opportunity to get those type of write-ups. So Chicago Guns Matter want to make sure that we can reach these people and educate them. Just like you said, Mr. Otis McDonald, Miss Mary Shepherd, Michael Moore, as well as Sean Gowder, all the people who have stood up, fought against this city to make sure that we can exercise our rights. We want to make sure these people get this and understand it, because no one else is going to do that. So if we can break through and reach out to this demographic of people and get them involved, then we're doing a great job. We're doing a great job. And like you say, trying to reach the people is basically what our intentions are, so that we can educate them as much as we possibly can and get these numbers up and get them involved and get them trained, so that they don't become a part of this negative vibe in the city of Chicago with the violence, or be a statistic, or end up losing loved ones, or just so that they're safe, they can protect themselves, and they can choose to do that. But we want to make sure that we offer that from Chicago Guns Matter.
Talking again with Rhonda Ezell from Chicago Guns Matter. And, you know, Ron, I don't know that I've ever asked you this question, but how did you get started shooting? Did you grow up in a gun-owning family? Did your mom or dad teach you how to shoot? What is your story?
Missouri is living in the city of Chicago. You better pay attention.
That's your story.
Well, the story is many years ago, I was living in a bad neighborhood in the city of Chicago, and it was some gangbangers wanted to threaten my son, who was very young at the time, and I wasn't having it. So I went to the store. I purchased my first firearm, and I proceeded to learn how to shoot that firearm for the safety of me and my family. So at the end of the day, if you don't take responsibility as a mother to protect your family, you know, what would you allow?
Mm-hmm.
And that's basically how I got into the firearm thing. Just basically with someone threatening my child, and I wasn't having it, and I'm still not having it.
You know, and yet, Rhonda, the anti-gun folks out there, Shanna Watts was just on MSNBC this past weekend saying that the gun control fight is between the caring folks of America and then the gun lobby. The fight over gun safety. On the one side, there are the people who care about other people, and then there's the big bad gun lobby. She would throw you in with the big bad gun lobby, but you seem like the reason why you are fighting for the Second Amendment is because you care about people.
Of course, but Shannon wasn't here when I was face to face with an intruder trying to come through my bedroom window and nearly, you know, committing a home invasion on me. So she can pass judgment on whatever it is, because I don't know where she lives. If she was here in Chicago, she would probably be on the same side as us as well. Because at the end of the day, they may not come. It's not their job to protect an individual if you call 911. So, you know, you're going to have those people who always disagree or always want to make things one-sided because it's something that they're against or something that they don't believe in. But they don't understand. It only takes 2 seconds to sit down and think before you speak.
Yep. It does. I'm guessing she probably thought before she spoke. I'm guessing that was the message she intended to send. I just think it was just egregiously wrong. And to me, it indicates the desperation of the anti-gun movement, where they have to portray people like you and other gun owners out there as uncaring, when, you know, again, this is why you fight. This is why you got involved, why you continue to be active, because you care about your son's safety, you care about your family, and you know that there are, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of Chicago residents who care just as much about their kids and their personal safety. And you know, Rhonda, the same right to keep and bear arms that we have in Texas or Utah or West Virginia, it's the same right in Chicago. It's just not recognized yet.
Exactly. That's something that they have to appeal, that they're going to have to eventually swallow, because there will be more federal lawsuits against the city of Chicago. The more they push the fight, the harder we will fight. And we have to keep fighting so that they understand that these are our rights. And we're going to be here, and we're not going away.
Well, I'm really glad you're not going away, Rhonda. Listen, we love having you on the program. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Cam.
Absolutely. Rhonda Ezell with us here on Cam and Company. Allergies kicking in. So why don't we take a quick time out? And when we come back, Seton Motley from Less Government will be with us. Stick around. There's more Cam and Company on the way. So, not to start off on a really serious note, I'm very curious to know your thoughts on the airstrikes in Syria, as well as what the response has been from Russia today, the UN Security Council meeting. I mean, this is a serious a moment in our foreign policy, and it does have the potential for some big ramifications here.
Yeah, well, kick 'em hard. That's my attitude. I mean, the reality is, Kay, you've got a very torn environment right now. You've got people on the right and left criticizing President Trump, and you've got people on the right and left praising President Trump. Here's what it boils down to. He separated himself from those who will not and those who will last night. He is not going to do 4 years like a Barack Obama, or maybe 8 years like a Barack Obama, drawing red lines, making false threats. He has now made a statement to the world. I mean what I say, and I say what I mean. And I think on the long haul, this is very beneficial for the United States, for our freedom and the protection of our country. So let's keep that in mind, people. Oh, we're going to go to war. First of all, he is setting a standard, because if you don't let these folks know who you are, as in the President of the United States, and what you're going to be about early on, you're going to get, as you put it, a rope-a-dope for a very long time. And it's very hard to show up in the ninth inning of a baseball game and try to play the game. You have to start off right off the bat and set a standard. And considering the circumstances in which this has happened, let's go back to 2013, where the line was drawn in the red sand and they made these negotiations with Russia of all countries. I mean, mind you, the left has been complaining about Russia nonstop, but yet we trusted Russia to ensure that their buddy, Bashar al-Assad, would get rid of his chemical weapons. I'm sorry, I never thought that that was even probable, logical, or even real. In fact, anybody with half a brain, even a quarter of a brain, knew they kept their chemical weapons. Why wouldn't they? Russia was their ally. Russia has a naval base right there in Syria. This is beneficial to Russia to bow up with Bashar al-Assad and tell Jonathan Kerry, Secretary Kerry at the time, we got rid of those chemical weapons. They stated publicly, the administration, were 100% sure those chemical weapons are gone. They stated this unequivocally. It's on my Twitter handle. I posted it nonstop this morning. And then here comes Susan Rice with one of her other misleading statements, not even a few weeks ago, on the successes of this administration that removing the chemical weapons from Bashar al-Assad. They never happened. Never happened. I knew this ages ago when he was dropping barrel bombs on the Sunni people. When Bashar al-Assad has been blowing up his own people for some time, people, this is nothing that this now is just so extreme because we've seen it on the innocent civilians that are not necessarily the targets that he was going after that are ISIS affiliated or related. So let's just be honest here. This is something that was preset by President Obama, the line in the sand. It took President Trump, though, now to make sure that that red line is dug deep and it's embedded in the forehead of Bashar al-Assad. He's not crossing it again. It's really simple here.
You know, and going back to the idea that Barack Obama sort of left this mess, and I'll tell you, Jesse, I think we're going to see this in the months to come where Barack Obama's inaction, that idea of leading from behind, left the world, I think, in a more precarious position, left the world in a more dangerous space. And I think over the next couple of months, we're going to see the bills, you know, start to come due in a lot of arenas here. I don't think it's just going to be Syria where we see this play out. I think there are other theaters. I think we're watching this with North Korea right now as well. And, you know, I think Barack Obama's attitude was, look, as I will delay, I will push things off to the side, I will kick cans down the road, so that in my time in the White House, everything is calm. And if it all goes to hell after I'm out,
it's
right?
Not my fault.
Well, he doesn't get the blame for it. Not his fault. Exactly.
Yeah. President Trump's getting blamed for doing what President Obama should have done and taken care of at this point. Now, we were probably not going to remove Bashar al-Assad. Al-Assad is kind of like the worst of the worst. At the same time, removing him could cause the same thing that we saw, the collapse in Iraq. We cannot redo nation building anymore. If we didn't learn anything out of Iraq, we cannot do nation building.
Welcome back to Cam and Company. Glad you are with us here on a Wednesday. Brian Ben Simon of Students for Concealed Carry going to join us about 40 minutes from now. Right now, Seton Motley from Less Government is with us on the program. Hey, Seton, how are you, sir?
Good afternoon, sir. How are you?
I am fantastic. I appreciate you joining us on the program today. And your headline, New York's overreaching, micromanaging. See, I thought you were talking about Mayor Bill de Blasio and his continued war on tobacco. But, talking about what's going on in New York with Andrew Cuomo. Can we talk about Bill de Blasio and tobacco for a second, though?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. Sure.
Can we?
It's your show.
Okay. Well, thanks. I appreciate that. Yeah, I always like to... I'm a generous host. You know, I don't want to like spring topics on you, but de Blasio has been tweeting out today. He says, we're going to raise the floor on the cost of a pack of cigarettes from $10.50. This is the tax, yeah. Right? $10.50 to $13, the highest price in the country. Cracking down on tobacco sales, Seton. Now, from what I understand, illicit tobacco sales make up almost 60% of the cigarette sales in New York State right now.
Oh, yeah, the Lucy's, the guy that died in the street.
Eric Garner.
Selling individual cigarettes, yeah. Lucy's.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So from a less government perspective, when you add taxes like this, making cigarettes $13 in New York City, the highest price in the country, does that crack down on the illicit market, or does that fuel the illicit market?
It fuels it. And I remember when I first went up to New York, I was aghast at the pictures of lungs that they have to show, you know, diseased lungs that they have to post at places where they sell cigarettes. And my first favorite point to make in all these circumstances, whether it's de Blasio and the cigarette taxes or Philadelphia with their stupid soda tax, is, hey, the left is finally admitting that increased taxes decrease economic activity. They finally admitted it. Hey, look at that. They specifically say they're raising taxes to dissuade people from smoking cigarettes or drinking sodas. Why does that not apply when you raise income taxes or raise any other kind of taxes? All of a sudden, the laws of economics applies when it comes to cigarettes and to sodas, but nowhere else on the planet, apparently, according to the left.
Apparently. Yeah, well, there are some inconsistencies in their positions. De Blasio also said on Twitter today, there are 29 times more tobacco sellers than Starbucks in New York City, which, by the way, you want to talk about an apples to rutabagas comparison. There are 20 times more tobacco sellers than Starbucks. Okay, well, what about establishments where you could get a cup of coffee? What's the comparison there? Because that's the actual where you could get tobacco products,
you're choosing one brand name versus the entire, the entire infrastructure of selling cigarettes. That's
right?
Exactly right.
But de Blasio says, we're going to go after licensing, and we're going to cap that. So apparently de Blasio wants to restrict the number of places where tobacco products are sold.
And this is another little thing I get. They're in such a hurry to legalize pot and outlaw cigarettes. And just from a health perspective, a joint is 7 times hotter on your lungs than a cigarette is. And therefore, dramatically worse for you from a health perspective, let alone what it does to your brain.
Listen, give de Blasio time, and he'll ban pot too. Give it time. He'll regulate that out of existence too. It's the nature of the left. They want to ban their way to safety. They want to ban their way to health. As a matter of fact, you know, he's talking about. Last fall, de Blasio was talking about having the supervised injection sites for heroin addicts, so they could go and they could shoot up under the watchful eye of a medical professional, right? And yet today he's talking about most of us have a story of the people in our lives who've ended up in the clutches of tobacco. It has a devastating impact on their lives. The answer there, again, with tobacco, right, is to make it as hard as possible to smoke. Can't smoke in a bar, can't smoke outside, can't smoke in a public park, can't smoke, can't smoke, can't smoke. Where's the designated smoking site for smokers in New York City? If heroin addicts, Seton, get to shoot up safely, where can a smoker go have
heroin
a cigarette?
Heroin addicts get a safe space, but cigarette smokers do not. One of my favorite comedian right now, at least, well, believe it or not, he used to smoke pot and drink, and now he's cleaned himself up and cut his hair, and I haven't found anything that's as funny since he did that, but his name is Steve Hughes. He's Australian. And he talked about that. You know, he said, he's like, can you still buy cigarettes? Of course. Where can you smoke them? Nowhere. It's like, you can smoke them out in the woods under a blanket with a torch. That's the only place you can smoke them. You know, and, you know, it's this, my, you know, I always say conservatives say, I don't like it, I won't do it. And leftists say, I don't like it, you won't do it. And I think the cigarette, look, I've never smoked anything in my life, cigarettes, anything. The only time I smoked anything was I played a stoner in a movie once, and I had to take all these hits off a bong filled with Siberian ginseng cigarettes crushed up into the bowl. That's the only time I've ever smoked anything. I don't care. This is not about me. This is about, first of all, bars and restaurants. This is private property where they can do whatever the hell they want. And the government's coming in and saying, no, you can't. You can't allow smoking in your private business establishment. This is about freedom. This is not about my health or your health. And if I don't like it, I won't go to the restaurant. You know, the marketplace would shake itself out, and there'd be smoking places and non-smoking places. And the ones that did better, there'd be more of. And the ones that did worse, there'd be less of.
Talking again with Seton Motley from Less Government about the more government efforts there in New York City, the nanny state on steroids. And, you know, I think the rise of the New York nanny state, it certainly didn't begin with de Blasio, but Seton, I mean, he's ramping this up, right? I mean, this is still an expansion. And, you know, it's kind of cute to call it the nanny state, but frankly, what we're talking about is just an expansion of the state, in this case, local New York City government, but that has an incredible amount of power over people's lives, and these again into the most minute part of their lives, the government is still reaching in and saying, "Hey, you know what? We have control."
Putting the total back in totalitarian. They want to control everything. They want to dictate everything. Their way is the only way. Their way or the highway. And yeah, so they're going to do it with smoking. They're going to, you know, again, safe spaces for heroin users, and let's ban cigarettes. I mean, really? Those are your priorities. Okay.
Do you think that, here's the thing, though. Is there a political price to be paid for that, or are we so distracted as voters?
No. Look, there's a reason that, you know, 31 governors are Republicans, and you know, everybody wants to blame the loss of, you know, 1,100 seats up and down the ballot across the country solely on Obama. It's not just Obama. It's how far left the Democrat Party has gone. And that's why they're losing these seats up and down the ballot. So you're going to have these little leftist enclaves like California and New York City. I did the math. New York State, if you took out New York City, New York State was basically a tie between Trump and Clinton. So it's these little leftist enclaves. Some of them are states. You know, Rhode Island is gone. Vermont is gone. You know, California is gone. But most of the country, as indicated by, you know, it's not that the Republicans have messaged their way into power in all these places. They just stood there while the left went further and further left, as embodied by the Democrat Party. And people aren't standing by idly. They're voting for the non-insane party, and that's how the Republicans are winning.
Again, talking with Seton Motley from Less Government. You think did you see that in play last night in Georgia in the special election?
Well, yeah. I mean, look, there's 11 candidates. In these gerrymandered districts, you know, when it's overwhelmingly a Republican district, and you know, you're going to get this pile in. You're going to get a clown car of Republican candidates because, you know, whoever wins the Republican vote eventually wins the general. You know, the other guy got $8 million, $10 million, almost all of it from outside the district, outside the state. And, you know, once the runoff happens, it's going to shake out, you know, better than Trump did there, but not as well as Mitt Romney did in that district. You know, Mitt Romney won it by like 30% or something. Mm-hmm. Trump won it by like 2%. So it'll be somewhere between there, and it'll be what it normally is. It'll revert to the main once you have a normal, serious one-on-one race rather than a jungle primary like that.
Yeah, well, and a special election where you get, as you say, a lot of outside money coming in. Although, I got to tell you, Sean, it's really fascinating to see some of these races, both Georgia's 6th district. There was a story in the Richmond Times-Dispatch today about Tom Perriello, who's one of the Democrats running for governor in Virginia. He's gotten, I think, $2.2 million he's fundraised this so far this year. About half of that's coming from four people from New York with the last name of Soros. And I
good thing the Democrats are getting the rich people out of politics.
Right? Yeah, we got to get big money out of politics, so they say. They want their big money in politics. But this is the thing. Like, I think this is an issue where, as you say, Democrats, look, they complain about Citizens United and, you know, corporations giving money to politics and corporations as individuals. But I think when you get tarred as a candidate, when you get fairly tarred as a candidate of not having the backing of people in your district or people in your state, but instead relying on outsiders, I think in this political environment, that is a huge check mark against
them. Well, I tend to agree. What I was reminded of when this was going on was, you remember in the height of the Obamacare passage, Scott Brown won in Massachusetts. You know, he won mm-hmm. that Senate seat. And then he came, you know, he lost to Elizabeth Warren, and then he came back and ran in New Hampshire, which is the last, you know, hold out hope of any Republican getting elected from New England, and they didn't elect him. Mm-hmm. I think in large part because, as you said, here's an outsider in the state. I think the old term carpetbagger, whether it's the politician himself or his support, still carries some weight. I think people like to be represented by people who actually represent their district. And as we know, Awful or whatever his name was yesterday doesn't actually live in the district he's trying to represent.
Yeah, but he's just supporting his girlfriend, and it's only like a mile and a half away. And
well, then why doesn't she support him? And
I have those very same questions. I mean, seriously, if you want to support your girlfriend and you only live a mile and a half outside of the district, I don't know. Maybe if you're running for Congress, maybe you guys just move a mile and a half. I know. I'm with you.
Yeah, there's only of the two prospective, you know, problems. The medical school, only one of them requires that you live somewhere, and it's not medical school. I'm just saying.
See, listen, I always enjoy talking with you, sir. Unfortunately, we are almost out of time this hour, but thank you, as always, for joining us on the program today.
Always a pleasure. Thank you very much, and I understand how anyone can get de Blasio and Cuomo mixed up.
Well, two sides of the same coin, I think. Seton, thank you, sir. We'll do this again very soon. Make sure you're following Seton on Twitter, at Seton Motley, lessgovernment.org as well. We've got the hero of the day, have our deal of the day, good guy coming up at the top of hour three. More evidence, again, of that sort of outside spending. So a news out of D.C. and out of Utah today that Jason Chaffetz will not seek re-election. Two sources have been informed of his decision, tell BuzzFeed News. Chaffetz said, since 2003, I've been fully engaged with politics as a campaign manager, a chief of staff, a candidate, and as a member of Congress. I've long advocated public service should be for a limited time and not a lifetime or full career. He said, many of you have heard me advocate, get in, serve, get out. He said, after more than 1,500 nights away from my home, it's time. I may run again for public office, but not in 2018. Over at Hot Air, Ed Morrissey has taken a look at the potential Democratic challenger for Jason Chaffetz in 2018, Catherine Allen. And the Salt Lake Tribune, Ed reports, said on Monday that a grassroots crowdfunding effort by Catherine Allen had raised nearly $400,000 more than Jason Chaffetz, according to the first quarter filings due on Saturday, with $534,000 in her account. Chaffetz had collected about $176,000, but he had $402,000 in cash on hand. The story is not that, you know, Jason Chaffetz was having trouble fundraising. We're still almost 2 years out. The story is that this potential challenger to Chaffetz was raking in cash. And again, a lot of that was coming from out of the state as well. Ed says more than 80% of Catherine Allen's larger donations came from outside of Utah. So in Georgia, had a lot of outside spending for John Ossoff. In Virginia right now, you got a lot of outside spending on Tom Perriello in the Democratic race. In Utah, a lot of outside spending on someone who is hoping to challenge Jason Chaffetz. What's if it's coming from out of state, what state is it coming from? New York? California? I would imagine. Now, again, if you want to take the money, take the money. But you also do have to explain how it is that that your values both align with a George Soros and your constituents in rural Virginia, or your potential constituents in rural Virginia, or how it is that, look, there are a lot of celebrities who support me and not a lot of native Utahns, but I'm here to represent you, the people. Got to make that argument. Got to make it convincingly. It's not an argument you have to make to the base. The base will be with the Democratic politicians. The louder and angrier the candidate will be, the more the base will be with them. But in Jason Chaffetz's district, that's not going to be enough to get you a win. In Georgia's 6th, it's not going to be enough to get you a win. And as you try to expand beyond the base, that's when the base turns and gets angry at you. All right, stick around. Hour 3 of Cam and Company is on the way, talking with the folks from Students for Concealed Carry. Stephen Cruiser with IJ Review, hero of the day, deal of the day, good guy and more. It's all coming up after a quick timeout, so stick around. Hour 3 of Cam and Company is coming up right after this. I'm curious. I know you've been following the Susan Rice story over the past couple of days, and not by watching CNN, by the way, because they're not talking about it. But what is your take on what we have heard to date, including Susan Rice's statement today that did nothing wrong? And yeah, there was probably some unmasking, but it was never for any political purposes, and she certainly never leaked anything, John.
Yeah, I think it's the world's greatest coincidence that Susan Rice just happened to ask for spreadsheets of information on U.S. persons who were engaged in completely lawful communications, who also just happened to be working for the campaign of the Republican candidate for president. I think Susan Rice thought she was going to be Secretary of State, not a suspect, and never thought she had to cover her tracks. It was supposed to be Hillary's coronation. I don't trust the word the woman says. And a couple of weeks ago, she said there was no unmasking. I've never heard of unmasking. I don't know what unmasking is. And now all of a sudden she did unmask people, but it's perfectly normal and did nothing wrong. That is complete nonsense. This is a political scandal that dwarfs every other political scandal.
Which I think is one of the reasons why the reaction from not just Susan Rice, but from other members of Team Obama has been little over the top, John. John Favreau earlier today on Twitter, I can't even read his tweet. It was just, you know, this is bleeping, bleep, bleep. You know, is it really? Because again, you know, Andrew McCarthy at National Review has the piece about the fact that Susan Rice would have had to ask, right? She can't simply demand that these names are unmasked. But as he points out, she's Obama's right hand in the White House. Are you really going to say no to Susan Rice? As a matter of fact, John Schindler, who is no fan of Donald Trump, writing at The Observer today about the intelligence community and the problems that Susan Rice had within the intelligence community. They didn't like her, he says, because she was abrasive. She was very authoritarian. And when they would put up a fight, when they would say, no, we don't think that it's necessary for you to have access to this information, a fight would ensue, and the intelligence community would be told, stand down, let her have this information. So, you know, it's not outside the it's really not outside the realm of possibility, given how political and politicized everything was during the Obama administration, that Susan Rice would have done this. At the same time, the Obama administration allowing the broader dissemination of these raw intelligence reports, so she wouldn't have to leak it. Barack Obama wouldn't have to leak it. No, they, you know, just the more names, the more people have access to this information, the more likely it is that someone is going to leak it out, right?
Oh, come on, Cam, stop. What does Andy McCarthy know? I mean, the guy was only one of the most successful prosecutors at the U.S. Attorney's Office in the Southern District of New York. I mean, you're actually listening to this guy and taking his word for it over, I don't know, Chris Cuomo, who said, hey, Susan Rice's friend said she didn't do it, so she didn't do it. I mean, when you weigh the evidence, I mean, yeah, got to go with Cuomo, right?
Sure, yeah. I mean, we were talking. I'm glad you mentioned Chris Cuomo because that, again, I think is a perfect tell. The news media has been telling us for months now, okay, you know what? We kind of screwed up America. We're going to get our act together. We're watchdogs now, all right? We're not going to let any malfeasance go unchecked. We've got our eyes on the government. And here's Chris Cuomo today on CNN. So, oh, fake scandal. Oh, it's just a fake scandal. Let me tell you about this fake scandal here. Okay, so this news just broke last night. There's a lot of questions that we don't know. There's no way in hell that any journalist knows where the story is going to go right now. But there's also no way in hell that a real journalist says, oh, I've determined this is a fake scandal and I'm not going to report on it anymore. There are way too many questions out there about this. Welcome back, hour three of Cam and Company. Starts right now on NRA TV, SiriusXM Patriot 125 and more. Brian Ben Simon with Students for Concealed Carry going to join us, responding to the fake ad for student body armor offered up by the anti-gun group at the University of Texas, Austin, because the sex toy thing, it's over and done with. Got to have something new to grab the media's attention. Stephen Cruiser of IJ Review joins us later in the hour as well. Plus, we have our hero of the day, deal of the day, good guy of the day. Jeremy Carl at National Review says it was not even a moral victory for Democrats in Georgia last night. He says, don't get me wrong, GOP absolutely facing headwinds in 2018. He says there's a lot of political ground left to cover in November. He says I'd certainly rather be in a position of winning districts by increasing margins rather than by decreasing margins. Could the GOP lose the House? Absolutely, he says. But, he says, the Senate not going to go Democratic in this political environment or anything close to it. He points out, he says, Ossoff's voters certainly energized. Volunteers, he says, came from all over the country. And 95% of his money came from outside of the district. He took a staggering 71% of the early vote, Carl says, showing that the most passionate Democrats, the same ones screaming at the GOP town halls, they're definitely motivated. He says there just doesn't seem to be enough of them right now to swing the number of elections that they need to win. And in Karen Handel, he says the GOP probably picked the strongest candidate to go up against Ossoff in the general election. Carl says the Georgia special election was a must win for the Democrats if they wanted to show that they had real political momentum on their side and a clear path to retake the House majority. They didn't get there. He says the reports of the electoral death of the GOP continue to be greatly exaggerated. Politico has a piece today kind of echoing this on when do Democrats actually get to win an actual victory as opposed to the moral victories that they have declared in Kansas and now in Georgia. This is Gabriel De Benedetti at Politico. And he writes, for all the anger, energy, and money swirling at the grassroots level, Democrats didn't manage to pick off the first two Republican-held congressional seats that they contended for in the Trump era, and the prospects are not markedly better in the House races coming up. There's the special election at large in Montana at the end of May, South Carolina on June 20th, Mick Mulvaney's seat there in South Carolina. Politico says the best shot at knocking Donald Trump down a peg appears to be Ossoff's runoff against Karen Handel, also scheduled for June the 20th. But Ossoff will be an underdog in that contest where there won't be a crowded field of Republicans to splinter the vote. After that, De Benedetti rides, it'll be a further 5 months before the New Jersey and Virginia elections for governor, leaving some strategists and lawmakers wondering how to keep the furious rank-and-file voters engaged in fueling and funding the party's comeback, especially given the sky-high expectations that surrounded Ossoff's ultimately unsuccessful run at the 50% threshold that was necessary to win the seat outright. Hawaii Senator Brian Schatz decrying, Politico says, some of the party's messaging describing the prospect of an Ossoff loss as devastating. Schatz says the resistance has it right. They're fighting mad, but they find joy in the fight. I'll be really honest with you. I do listen to SiriusXM Progress on occasion, along with the POTUS and Patriot. I don't hear a lot of joy right now in the fight. I don't. I kind of wish I did. Might make me feel a little bit better about where this country's going. I'm not hearing a lot of joy. Shad says, it's not that anybody should be expected to gloss over the challenges that we have or be Pollyanna about our situation as a country or a party. It's just that there has to be a sense of momentum that builds over time, and that requires that we define our objectives tightly and that we are prepared to lose more than we win for the time being, but that we understand that we have the vast majority of the American people on our side and we have history on our side. Well, you know, Team Motley last hour mentioned the, 1,100 seats at the state level that have been lost by the Democrat Party during the Obama era. I said, you know, it's not all Obama. It is the reflection of the party and how voters in these districts view the Democratic Party. So Shat says we got to define our objectives tightly. We got to be prepared to lose more than we win for the time being. Well, they've been losing more than they've been winning at the state level for a number of years. They've been losing more than they've been winning in the House of Representatives for a number of years. And if I got to tell you, I mean, if I were a member of the hashtag the resistance, I would hear what Senator Shatz is saying. I roll my eyes at it because that just sounds like it does sound like Pollyanna-ish talk. Okay, we got to be motivated, but we're going to lose a lot more. Thanks, Senator. Thanks. Politico says, with ASA falling short of an outright win, despite an unprecedented surge of campaign cash and national attention, comes the potential for another round of finger-pointing within the party. The worry that if operatives and voters continue their practice of quietly blaming one another for losses, and note, by the way, Politico says quietly blaming. Because, again, the fractures and the rifts within the party, the Democratic Party, are not interesting to the media, the largely Democratic media. They don't want to highlight those tensions. They don't want to build them up. They certainly don't want to spotlight them or do anything to exacerbate those tensions. Their role, they see, is to smooth things over, to gloss over the hurdles that the party facing and the intra-party fighting. Politico says, the worry is that the current level of runaway enthusiasm and budding trust in the National Party leadership could sputter out long before the 28-term midterms. Simon Rosenberg, president of the Indian think tank, says whatever happens over the next few weeks, it's critical that rank-and-file Democrats feel like the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee left it all on the playing field. And that goes back even to the confirmation fight over Neil Gorsuch. A fight, again, that Democrats in the Senate knew that they were going to lose. They knew they were going to lose that fight. They knew that by having that fight and by going to the mat for the a filibuster for Supreme Court nominees with Neil Gorsuch, they knew they were going to lose. They knew they were going to put themselves in a corner. They were not going to be in a place where they could better lobby the for or against the next appointment to the Supreme Court by President Trump. They knew all of these things. And that didn't matter as much as trying to appease the angry base, which wants to see the leadership fight, 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 fight. But soon, and it may be like now, it may be that the bitter disappointment on the left over the fact that John Ossoff didn't get 50%, I think the shift is going to go from fight, fight, fight to fight and win. Fight and win. And if they don't get the victories in these special elections coming up in Montana, coming up in South Carolina, again, districts that Montana's at large, so it's the entire state. They've elected Democrat governors. They've elected Democrats to statewide office, but Ryan Zinke was able to win his seat pretty handily there in Montana. Mick Mulvaney's seat in South Carolina, again, that would be a big lift, but the tactical considerations for the base there, they're not concerned about that. They're not concerned about what the odds might be or things. They want to fight. They want to win. And if they're not winning, they're going to get really angry about losing. And why should we continue to pour money into these races if we're not going to win? That's what the Democratic Party leadership is deathly afraid of right now. And the runoff coming up in Georgia in June, don't think it's going to make the party leadership feel any better. All right, let's get to our hero of the day, our deal of the day, and our good guy. Hero of the day comes from KSWO, Channel 7 in Lawton, Oklahoma. Authorities say a man is dead after police say he was shot while trying to break into a woman's home in Lawton. Happened around 8:30 in the morning yesterday, Tuesday, April 18th. When police got to the scene, they found a man identified as Rocky Stamper, unresponsive, taken to the hospital where he later died. Channel 7 says officers took the homeowner to the police department to interview her as their investigation continues. Neighbors say the neighborhood is noisy. One woman named Hillary said, sometimes I think it's people just shooting off fireworks, but they might be shooting guns. It's just kind of panicky, you know. We're fairly new to the neighborhood, she said, so we just try to keep an eye out. Another neighbor was outside his home at the time of the shooting. A few construction workers were there. He said, we didn't hear a bang, a big bang or anything like that. We were trying to figure out where the shots came from. One of them said right away, maybe you should call the cops. So I did. One neighbor says it's a wake-up call for her and her family. She'll be extra cautious from here on out. Police have not yet released the name of the homeowner. We'll keep our eyes on that story. But again, that homeowner defending her home against a burglar there in Lawton, Oklahoma. Today's hero of the day. Our deal of the day. Got a couple for you, unfortunately. First from KMOV, St. Louis, Missouri. Dateline Arnold, Missouri. Bill Dobbs lives in Arnold. He's 85. He's in the hospital right now because he got attacked by a stranger with a hammer. He was working in his front yard Friday afternoon. Car pulls up. Woman gets out. He looks at the woman, says, can I help you? You need to talk to somebody? And she didn't answer. Eventually, she tried to walk into Bill Dobbs' home, and that's when Mr. Dobbs confronted her. Woman pulled Dobbs inside the house, knocked him down, and then attacked him. Dobbs' daughter, Deneen Scott, said he had a claw hammer on his face and head. She grabbed a knife. She started stabbing him. She stabbed him in the stomach, in the leg, broke a mason jar over her dad's head. According to the Arnold Police Department, an officer had been dispatched on reports of a car driving erratically. He discovered the car in front of Mr. Dobbs' home. He got out of the car, and he heard Mr. Dobbs yelling, help, she's trying to kill me. His daughter, Deneen Scott, said if the officer hadn't arrived when he did, her father would have been killed. 43-year-old Geraldine Combs has been arrested, charged with first-degree assault, burglary, and armed criminal action. Police say she has yet to give an explanation for the attack, but they do note that she has a long criminal history with over 20 convictions dating back to 1996. What she was doing out on the street instead of behind bars or in an institution remains to be discovered, but she is today's deal of the day. And we also have a deal out of Oklahoma. Mulhall, Oklahoma. Logan County Sheriff's Deputy David Wade shot and killed this week. The suspect in this case, another individual known to police. The deputy had gone out to a home to serve an eviction notice, but the guy who shot him, who allegedly shot the officer, was not the individual who was being evicted. Suspect in this case, a guy by the name of Nathan Aaron LaForce of Perry, Oklahoma. They still don't know the motivation for this, but he shot and killed Deputy Wade. In 2001, media reports note, LaForce pleaded no contest to use of a firearm during the commission of a felony in eluding an officer. At the time, officers said that they suspected this was an attempted suicide by cop. He drove, engaged the police in a chase at speeds greater than 90 miles an hour. He led the officer to a cemetery where his father was buried. climbed out of his car, pointed a gun at the officer. Officer ordered LaForce to drop the rifle. When LaForce refused, the officer fired at the car, blowing out a tire. LaForce sped away. Officer lost sight of him. Several hours later, he was taken into custody as he walked down a road. He got 4 years probation in that case. No jail time whatsoever. No mental health services, from what I've been able to tell. Just check in with your probation officer every now and then. Keep your nose out of trouble. And if you do that, you go your merry way. Well, he couldn't keep his nose out of trouble. 2007, LaForce pleads no contest to obstruction of an officer. Ordered to spend a year in the Noble County Jail. Don't know if he spent the whole year there. Charged in a bogus check case in 2010. That case dismissed after he paid restitution. 2015, LaForce charged with kidnapping, child endangerment, and domestic abuse. That case, for whatever reason, was dismissed in 2016. And in August of 2016, authorities charged him with harboring a runaway child and contributing to the delinquency of a minor, but that case also dismissed, quote, in the interest of justice. So the suspect, again, in the death of Deputy Wade, 45 years old, a long criminal history. And again, perhaps the best opportunity to maybe turn this guy's life around came with his very first arrest when he walked away with probation after threatening a law enforcement officer's life. Nathan Allen LaForce there in Perry, Oklahoma, our second deal of the day. Our good guy from WCPO, Delhi Township, Ohio. It was Easter Sunday. Family headed back to Nashville. They've been in Ohio for the Easter weekend, spending time with family. Coleman and Abby Flynn driving home. Started raining. Coleman Flynn said there were a lot of puddles we had to drive through. And then they hit a big puddle. Car stalls out. He said, I tried to start the car multiple times, started back up, wouldn't start. Opens up his car door. Water comes rushing in. He said, that's when we realized we had a problem. Stuck there in a vehicle as the floodwaters rise. He, his wife, their five-week-old baby in the back seat. Abby said, I really didn't care what happened to us. We just have to get the baby out of the car. That's what she was thinking. WCPO says then Abby Flynn noticed a woman, complete stranger, who wanted to help. They were able to turn the battery on and off to get the window down. They collapsed the car seat. They pushed the baby out the window to the woman, to the stranger. Abby said several people at that point calling 911 while the woman ran the five-week-old child to safety and then came back to help the couple out of the car. Coleman Flynn said we also had to get out the passenger window because we couldn't open the doors of the car. Abby Flynn said the couple got the stranger's first name. But all the craziness, they didn't get to thank her. And Abby said, I don't even want to think about where we would be if she hadn't been willing to help people she didn't even know. Car's a total loss, but the Flynn family is okay. They made it back to Nashville, I think, on Tuesday. And WCPO tracked down that stranger. Her name is Sandra Patterson. She was on her way to the grocery store. When the deep water there on the road forced her off into a parking lot. She said, I'd never seen a road flood like that. It looked like the Ohio River. And when this stranger saw what was happening right in front of her, she said, she just wanted to help. She said, it's nothing that I would normally do, but something just told me to go down there. She said, I went out and did what I hoped somebody would do for me if it was me and my family. Well, I suspect that you're right, and hopefully Sandra Patterson or Sandra Patterson's family ever in a situation like that, maybe a stranger will come to their aid. But for being in the right place at the right time, but more importantly, for doing the right thing and helping out strangers in need. Sandra Patterson, thank you for being one of the many, many good guys out there. All right, when we return here in this edition of Cam and Company, Brian Ben-Simon with Students for Concealed Carry going to join us. Yes, the anti-gun group at the University of Texas Austin is back. They had their sex toy protest to start off the school year, and now they're closing out the academic year with a fake ad for student body armor in their latest protest against campus carry. Stick around. We'll talk about it with the folks from Students for Concealed Carry right after a quick break.
If 10 states made it a felony to read the New York Times, the media would run the story 24/7 until Congress fixed the assault on the First Amendment. But when 10 states criminalize the Second Amendment, the media says nothing. They don't report that honest, well-meaning people, nurses, stay-at-home moms, veterans, even a disaster relief worker, have been charged with felonies for simply having a lawfully owned firearm. Each was legally licensed to carry a firearm in their home state, but arrested and charged as criminals when safely carrying it through another, less free state. When states can deny one constitutional freedom, they can criminalize the entire Bill of Rights. On behalf of America's 100 million gun owners, we will fight until the full measure of our Second Amendment freedom is restored to every citizen in every corner of the land. We are the National Rifle Association of America, and we're freedom's safest place.
To every dishonest member of the failing American news media, let me explain why you've never been less trusted, less credible, or less respected. For decades, you ignored calls from millions of gun owners to just tell the truth. All you had to do was just get the facts right about our guns and our freedom. But you never even pretended to listen. Instead, you weaponized the First Amendment against the Second. And now the whole country sees you for the mockery we've always known. Your claim to the truth is as legitimate as a thief's. If the fate of individual freedom had rested in your hands, America would have fallen long ago. But Americans put their trust somewhere else. And now, in that place, stands the most trusted defender of individual freedom in American history. We're the National Rifle Association of America, and we're freedom's safest place.
It's great to be here to celebrate our freedom and those American values that we all hold dear.
The NRA has led the fight time and time again to protect our fundamental freedoms.
You're the tip of the spear, the ironclad face of tens of millions of patriots all over this country.
The NRA has not only protected our Second Amendment rights over the years, but it's also shown us all how to fight for the rest of our rights.
To the anti-gun left, the common enemy is the National Rifle Association, and you, its freedom-loving members.
Where others have talked, you fought. Where others have lost, you've won. We're the most fearsome grassroots army in the history of freedom.
American freedom is safer in this room than anywhere else on the planet.
Every animal that has ever roamed this planet was designed as hunted or hunter, predator or prey. We are hunters. If it were ever necessary, even the strictest vegan would return to the wild, driven to survive by the instincts of his ancestors. Those who hide behind the soft delusion of their own ignorance do so from within a civilization whose very being costs the lives of countless creatures every single day. Death is an undeniable fuel of life. This is the undeniable truth of existence. To live in balance with the planet that sustains us, we must admit and embrace the nature within us. Trust the hunter in your blood.
Your first source for Second Amendment news and information, it is Cam and Company. Glad you are with us. Stephen Cruiser of IJ Review, still to come on the program. Right now, though, from Students for Concealed Carry, Brian Ben Simon is with us. Brian, how you doing, sir?
Hi, Cameron. It's good to be with you.
It is. It's good to have you. And once again, the anti-campus carry group at UT Austin trying to make some headlines here. They have a new faux ad that they have released. And before we get into this conversation, Brian, let's play the ad so folks know what it is here that we're talking about. Take a look and a listen to the newest ad from the anti-gun group there at UT Austin.
Hey, kids! Are you looking at colleges in one of these nine states? Well, lucky you! Because all of them have campus carry laws where virtually anyone with a license can bring a gun onto school grounds. Don't get caught in the crossfire! Get Student Body Armor! A proprietary blend of Type 2 body armor and school pride. Yes, we've got all your bulletproof college swag needs! Sweatshirts! T-shirts! Even hoodies! Need even more protection? Try the all-new Hurt Locker! Helmets sold separately. Still not convinced? Check out these satisfied customers.
How does it feel?
Awkward.
Awkward?
Really awkward.
Weirdest thing that I've ever worn.
How much is one?
Well, the sweatshirts are $900.
Missed our pop-up store? Armor up online. Wish your school had it? We'll be there soon. Price too steep? Not to worry. Protect yourself for free. Just call your local representative and tell them campus carry is almost as ridiculous as student body armor.
So there you go. Student body armor is a joke. Campus carry is not, they say. Boy, I got to tell you, Brian, they've... I guess they had their sex toys donated. I don't know who donated the little traveling trailer that they had, the pop-up trailer. These folks must be getting for you know, poor college students. They're getting a lot of funding.
Yeah, no, I think as you alluded to, this was pretty well financed. But what I was wondering, I mean, the video seemed a little bit discriminatory. I mean, what about those of us that go to a college that maybe doesn't have a football team? I mean, I went to the University of Texas at Dallas. We didn't even have a football team, and I didn't even see any gear for the people at college campuses for a university like that. So maybe they ought to add some Dallas Cowboys gear or maybe some professional sports teams.
Then, well, you know, I don't know. UTA probably gonna, you know, wink and a nod to the licensing there. I don't know if Jerry Jones would be quite so forgiving. That might explain it. But look, here's the thing. We are almost to the end of the first school year since campus carry was instituted, and there have been no problems, Brian, at UT Austin. I mean, the problems and the fear that the anti-gun groups are constantly putting forth, they haven't come to pass. I mean, what we've seen is a campus that I think has really stopped caring about campus carry as an issue. I don't see it as a big issue or a big priority for a lot of students there on campus.
I think that's exactly right. Generally, the people that do still care about the issue are those that are trying to expand concealed carry on campus. So that means not allowing professors to have the individual discretion to ban it from their personal offices, which is a problem that we've dealt with at UT and several of the other University of Texas campuses. But one thing that ought to be mentioned, though, is that when we look at this issue of mass shootings, it's something where there's been about 200 instances of mass shootings since 2007 on college campuses that don't have concealed carry. Now, it's not something that we have said concealed carry makes campuses more safe, but you can't say that concealed carry makes campuses less safe. And so for them to paint our issue as something that is ridiculous, I think just doesn't quite jive with reality.
No, in fact, and I know you and I have talked about this before, but it wasn't at UT Austin, but was it Texas State University, the student senate there, voting in favor of expanding campus carry?
Yeah, the student senate at Texas State University voted to expand concealed carry and essentially make the entire campus a concealed carry campus. And what's unique is that the vote was actually 27-5, so it wasn't just a majority, but really an overwhelming majority. And one thing I think to the credit of the anti-campus carry people that made this video is that they want to make it a national video. This is meant for a national audience. So I think they've kind of given up the fight in Texas, probably because they know that people do enjoy the law in Texas and that it's unlikely to go away anytime soon. So I think they're trying to focus on the national conversation. But, you know, we at Students for Concealed Carry, I mean, we absolutely welcome that. You know, we're ready for that national conversation, and we want to see campus carry expanded in other states.
And obviously the anti-gun groups, whether they're at UT Austin or University of Georgia or there in Michael Bloomberg's offices, they don't want to see campus carry expanded. And it doesn't matter how many states have passed this without issue. Frankly, the arguments against the arguments that they make against students or faculty caring for self-defense, they say, you know, in essence, there's no problem. The only problem is you, the gun owner, Brian, right? You're the issue, and you wanting to carry a firearm is the issue, not people who want to actually carry for self-defense, not the violent crimes that are occurring on college campuses or occurring right off college campuses. All that, just that's just noise. The real issue is you and your demand for your rights.
Yes, because the thing is, the issue of concealed carry on campus, it's only about where you can carry. So it actually doesn't have anything to do with gun ownership. And so a lot of the people that are looking at this issue are more just generally anti-gun. But the thing is, you can hold a number of different policy viewpoints. You could be against constitutional carry or be against open carry, but still be in favor of concealed carry on campus. And the reason that you would want to do that is because you want to make the law more uniform and make the law more consistent. Here in Austin, I mean, we have the Bob Bullock Museum right next to campus. We have several restaurants that allow concealed carry at campus. And we have the Texas State Capitol, which also allows concealed carry. So to say that you can have concealed carry at all of those places, but that the minute that you step on the college campus, that you're not allowed to do it anymore, that's just something that doesn't make a lot of sense. And I think that was a big reason why we did get SB 11 passed and why we did get concealed carry implemented on campus.
I think you're right. Brian, listen, unfortunately, we are running out of time here, but I do appreciate you coming on the program. And I'm curious, I mean, has this ad, do you think this has had, I certainly don't think it's changed anybody's mind, but do you think this ad will have the impact or the effect of generating more attention to the campus carry issue?
Yeah, I mean, there was certainly a lot of energy on the anti-campus carry side last August, and I certainly wouldn't try to discredit the people like Jessica Jin, who put a lot of effort into marketing this anti-campus carry movement, because they really did do a good job of getting a lot of national attention on this issue. But frankly, at Students for Concealed Carry, we are kind of thankful for some of that national attention because we think we can use it to expand concealed carry in other states. But as far as what happened at our campus, I mean, it's something where the activism against campus carry really died down over time. And not only did we have one successful semester, but we're winding down on our second semester of campus carry here and still no major incidents.
Nope. And hopefully it stays that way. Brian, thank you very much for coming on the program, sir. It's always good talking with you.
Yeah, absolutely. Anytime, Cameron.
All right. Thank you, sir. Brian Ben Simon with Students for Concealed Carry here on Cam and Company. You're looking here at a couple of news stories. Albuquerque, New Mexico. University of New Mexico police, woman robbed student in dorm room. Auburn University, police remind Auburn University to stay alert after a robbery on campus Tuesday night. Berkeley police searching for a man suspected of an attempted strong-arm robbery. Buffalo man charged in Alfred University robbery. That's just, again, over the past couple of days on college campuses. Three men charged in an invasion, armed robbery of a Southern Illinois University apartment. Police named man who attempted two robberies near VCU, Virginia Commonwealth University in Richmond, shot one victim. That was yesterday. Weber State Police in Utah looking for two suspects in an on-campus armed robbery. Winthrop Police arresting two Rock Hill teens in a March campus armed robbery of a pizza delivery driver. You know, again, the idea that college campuses are safe spaces is ludicrous. They're not safe spaces in terms of violent crimes not happening. They may increasingly be quote unquote safe spaces in terms of ideas and thoughts that a student may disapprove of, never ever getting a hearing on campus. But they're not safe spaces for students and faculty when it comes to violent crime. They can still be victims. They can still be targets. And that is why you have seen the expansion of campus carry, because your right of self-defense doesn't end when you set foot on a college campus ground. Stephen Cruiser of IJ Review going to be with us here in just a couple of minutes. Quickly, though, before we take our last time out here, Jeff Sessions, we're going to talk about this a little bit more on tomorrow's program, but Attorney General Jeff Sessions, according to the Hill newspaper, it says the MS-13 gang can be designated as a terrorist organization. Sessions was on Tucker Carlson last night, and he was asked whether that designation would be helpful. He said, I think so, perhaps. He says, I believe it could qualify for that. He said, there are rules, I guess, that the State Department does to establish this. El Salvador, the Hill notes, has already designated MS-13 as a terrorist group. Sessions called the gang one of the most violent gangs in the history of our country. He said, we can devastate this gang. We're going after them. We're not going to allow them to take over a block, a corner of our communities, and terrorize people with this violence. The Hill says members of MS-13, known for their violent methods, fierce gang loyalty. According to the National Gang Intelligence Center, they have more than 10,000 members in the United States, more than 30,000 members worldwide. MS-13, as I said previously, declared a terrorist organization by El Salvador. The gang actually started here in the United States, started in L.A. In the 80s, and their big rival was the 18th Street, also now with a major presence in Central America. And a major drug trafficking presence. It's not like these guys are, these gangs are fighting over turf as to, you know, who gets to hang out where. No, no, no. This is about who gets to sell the drugs in any given community, on any given corner, in any given neighborhood. And the violence that is plaguing so many communities, again, the root of that violence, oftentimes centered in the gangs that are involved in the drug trafficking, like MS-13. So I got to tell you, I was heartened to hear Attorney General Sessions talking about the zero tolerance for gang violence. He said, we'll secure our border, we'll expand immigration enforcement, we'll choke off supply lines. That alone, by the way, won't be enough. All of the efforts of the federal government will not be enough to stop this. But it is a good place to start by letting these gangs know that we're not going to be going easy on them. All right, stick around. We're not going to go easy on Stephen Cruiser either. He'll join us after a quick break. Weekend editor there at IJ Review. Stick around. More Cam and Company coming up right after this.
People will go and they'll celebrate, but then we'll leave their resolve to get up the next day and fight like hell for this freedom because it deserves it and it's necessary because there are others who are getting up every day trying to destroy everything we believe in, and not just from a Second Amendment standpoint, but as a country. This is a culture war. Cam, you and I have been talking about it for years, and it rages on. You can still pick up the newspaper and read stories that just make you shake your head about kids getting suspended from school for, you know, pointing their finger in the shape of a gun the way, you know, kids do when they're playing cops and robbers or cowboys and Indians. Those things are still going on. We still have Michael Bloomberg out there worth somewhere between $40 and $50 billion, who's now committed $25 million to try to undermine the lawful use of firearms for self-defense. Not trying to keep criminals from getting access to firearms, but trying to prevent you and I from protecting our family if we take a road trip outside of our state of residence. That's what it is we're facing, but that's what we're prepared for. And we're going to get up every day, and we're going to take the fight to them, and we'll do whatever it takes day in, day out to protect this freedom. But we need our fellow NRA members across this country to stand with us. If we do it together, we're going to achieve some amazing things.
Absolutely. And I hope as many NRA members as possible can make it to Atlanta, whether it's your first time or it's your, you know, 10th time. There's nothing like it. I heard you say earlier that you walk away from an NRA meeting just energized. You're ready to go. And we've got so much to fight for right now. Again, from coast to coast, no matter where you live, there is something for you to be engaged in at the federal level, at the local level. Here in Virginia, we've got elections coming up. Michael Bloomberg spent millions last time around trying to flip our state Senate. I have no doubt he's going to try to do it again. We've got two gubernatorial candidates who are trying to out anti-gun one another right now over on the Democratic side. You've got special elections, one this week in Georgia. Up in Montana, Chris, I'm sure you've seen the story. Rob Quist, who's running as the Democrat there, talked about how we need to register quote-unquote assault weapons. He said they're only meant to kill people. And then he said, when he was trying to explain himself, he said, I was only talking about fully automatic assault rifles. You know, I'm sorry, Chris. I expect better from a candidate. Let's be clear about what he was talking about. He's talking about banning modern sporting rifles, registering these firearms that are the most common rifle sold in America today. And this apparently is the standard platform now for one of the two major parties in America. It is scary out there as a gun owner, and we have to fight back.
You're exactly right. Quist seems to prefer he'd rather climb up a tree and lie than stand on the ground and tell the truth about where he stands on the Second Amendment. And now they've got him coached up a little bit, and he gives a canned answer on supporting the rights of law-abiding people in Montana to own firearms. But if you live in Montana, it's critically important to know that you have a real supporter in the Second Amendment out there running against Quist, who's not a supporter at all. And this is a national race. All of these races now have national implications. As we discussed earlier, the amount of money that's being raised on the other side is staggering. We all woke up, as we've talked about before, we all woke up excited the day after the elections, and our opponents woke up very, very disturbed. You've seen how violent they've reacted. You've seen the media's reaction to try to undermine this president every step of the way. And it's up to us to serve as this president's grassroots army. It's up to us to go out there and win these special elections. It's up to us to go out there and fight regardless of where it takes us. Whether it's in the state legislatures, whether it's in the courts, or whether it's up on Capitol Hill. And the great thing about Atlanta and this great time of the year where we get together and celebrate all the things that we believe in and celebrate this individual freedom is that it doesn't matter where you're from. If you're from California, come so we can thank you because you played a role in helping elect this president. If you're happy with getting a Eric Holder type of attorney general out and getting a Jeff Sessions type of attorney general in, and you're from New York or New Jersey or Connecticut or Maryland and you support this organization, you played a role in making that happen. So come so we can all celebrate it together. But as you mentioned, we can also leave resolved to recognize that this fight's not over, that we still face a national news media, a mainstream media that's going to misrepresent the truth about this organization every step of the way, which is why it's so important that you're out there and Grant and everybody at NRA TV is out there telling the truth about what it is we stand for, telling the truth about what it is our opponents are really up to and what Michael Bloomberg's really all about. And it's not about trying to keep guns out of the hands of criminals. It's about trying to keep guns out of the hands of all of us other than his armed security personnel. So this is what we're facing, but we have a great opportunity if we work together, and I know that we'll do that together.
Mr. Steven Cruiser from IJ Review joins us here on Cam and Company. You can find me, by the way, on Twitter at Cam Edwards. You can find Steven at Steven Cruiser. That is Steven with a PH. That is Cruiser with a K. Steven, how are you, sir?
Fantastic. How are you doing today?
I am good. So there's so much to talk about. You want to talk about Bill O'Reilly? You want to talk about the soda tax in Berkeley? Did you see that they're declaring the soda tax in Berkeley to be a success, Stephen?
I think they tried that once already, and I seem to remember writing about it. I think this is like round two on them saying it's a great success. I'm not sure. I used to write so many posts a day. I vaguely remember writing that they were touting it a success like the second it was implemented.
Of course. I mean, immediate dramatic impact. So now it's been a year, and they say that in Berkeley, sales of sugar sweetened drinks fell by close to 10%. Sales of water increased by about 16%. And they say, aha, see, this shows that people aren't buying as much soda. Now, interestingly enough, the study also showed, Stephen, that sales of sugar-sweetened beverages in the cities surrounding Berkeley rose nearly 10%, which is not evidence of anything, apparently, according to the backers of the Berkeley soda tax.
Well, it's evidence of the fact that they seem to be completely unaware of the automobile. That's what it's evidence of. They seem to be not clear on the fact that we are a mobile society, especially in California, and we can go other places to buy things.
Maybe in Berkeley you can't. I don't know. Are cars frowned on in Berkeley?
I'm sure they are.
The internal combustion engine? I mean, maybe like if you have a Tesla or a smart car, you can get away with that, right?
I try to avoid that part of California. It's too bad because it really is gorgeous up there, too. But, wow, have they really screwed that part of California up? Worse so than the rest of the state.
Is there – okay, so as somebody who lives 3,000 miles away, I mean, you're there in the L.A. area. Is it really that much worse in the Bay Area than it is in L.A.? I sort of think of coastal California as just one big stretch of – nannying and despotism and restrictions on rights, but is it worse in the Bay Area?
They take it up a notch there, and it's even more pronounced because it's a smaller area. It's not as spread out as LA. And you have the raging leftist liberalism contrasting with the wealthiest part of America, who are all liberals too. They've all, you know, the Silicon Valley people and all the people in the, you know, they're pricing out the poor people there, and they're all liberals with good intentions. So it's the weirdest. It's been very interesting to watch in the last few years. Here in LA, you know, we have a lot of rich, wealthy Hollywood people too, but there's still a lot of regular entertainment people types like me here, people doing other things here. The contrast isn't as stark, probably because we're so spread out.
Okay. That makes sense. Although I don't know. I still don't see, again, from 3,000 miles away, you guys all kind of blend together in the California awfulness.
All Californians look alike to you. I got it.
Yes, that's it. All Californians look alike. By the way, I don't know, speaking of California, I don't know if you watched the show last night on A&E about the riots in California. The 25th anniversary of the LA riots. A&E, I think they're running this over the weekend as well. April 30th will be the 25th anniversary of the LA riots. Were you there in LA at the time, Stephen?
I lived in LA, and as was my luck most of the time, every time I was on the road almost constantly then, and every time something bad would happen at home, I'd be on the road. So I was doing a week-long gig in Atlantic City when that hit. I walked back from in between shows one night, walked back to my room, hit the TV, and found out what was going on. So I missed they'd all ended by the time I got home the next week.
I suppose that's a good thing. I don't know if I'd rather be in a riot-torn LA or Atlantic City. I mean, that's kind of six of one, half a dozen of the other. I mean, boy, that's tough, but I guess you were there. You didn't have a choice. You had to stay in Atlantic City.
Yeah.
So when you got back, was it one of those things that people were talking about? Was there any evidence outside of where the riots had taken place that LA had in fact gone through this a week previous?
Yeah, I lived on the west side, then I lived in Venice then, and, you know, the Venice was like the only west side area where some of the rioting hit. And so they were talking about it there. It really, the way I heard about it the most was my favorite comedy club in LA at the time to do sets was on the west side. In fact, it's walking distance from where I live now. And they got hit. Their traffic, their audiences just dropped off immediately after that, and they ended up closing down a couple of years later. They never recovered, and they used to do thriving business before that. They never recovered after the riots from that.
Wow. You know, the A&E special has an interview with a couple of the gun owners there in L.A. who defended themselves with firearms. I remember hearing Charlton Heston talk about how all of his anti-gun buddies called them up, Stephen, the day the riots broke out, and they were They were hoping, you know, Chuck, I know you've got some guns up there at the house. You think I could borrow one? And Chuck's having to explain to them, listen, that would be a violation of California law. No, I can't just loan you one of my firearms. You guys wanted these laws. Now you got to live with them. But there was a guy, David Jew, who's the former manager of the Western Gun Shop. And he said during the riots, he said, we'd already called the police. He said, I arrived here at the beginning. He said, I could see the LAPD vehicle with like three or four officers there. He told his boss, he said, oh, good, we got the police here. We're safe, right? He said, as soon as the gunfighting started, they ran away. The police left. They were out. They were outgunned. They were outmanned. They took off. And it was up to the citizens there in this neighborhood where the riots unfolding. They had to be able to protect themselves. And thankfully, you had a couple of individuals who worked at a gun shop who could, in fact, protect themselves.
You've hit on something that's perhaps the most nonsensical part of the entire liberal view of guns. It's, you know, when we say we want to be prepared for any eventuality, including something like that, they say we're paranoid, we're crazy, that kind of stuff never happens, you know. But these are the same people who will carry some sort of life insurance on the off chance that they get hit by a bus, you know. Nobody's ever planning for that stuff to happen. But there's nothing wrong with being prepared for it should it happen. And that's all any of us ever want to do. Like the scenario you just pointed out, when I think about my guns and I don't think, well, I'm going to need to go out and use this today. The only thing I ever think about is, what if some sort of rioting breaks out again? What if there's panic in the streets? What if there's trouble? And that's when I want to defend myself. And I'm quite content going the rest of my life never having to do so. But it doesn't mean I'm crazy. It doesn't mean I'm paranoid. And the same people who will fault me for being like that all carry a variety of insurance policies.
Yes, they do. But there are, see, again, it's the piece of paper, right? Carrying that insurance policy, it doesn't require you to actually do anything except pay your premiums. Right. And it doesn't require you to actually shoulder responsibility for your own safety, because actually what you're doing is you're just insuring yourself against if something bad happens to you. OK, I'm going to get a payout. I'm going to get a payday. But to me, it's like having a fire extinguisher or maybe not having homeowners insurance and thinking, well, I don't need a fire extinguisher now, Stephen, because I have homeowners insurance. So if something catches fire, I'm covered. Okay, that might be. I still want to put out the fire. I don't want to have a total loss in my home, right? I have homeowner's insurance. I've got a fire extinguisher, too.
Yeah, that's a perfect analogy right there. It's like, I mean, I've always had a fire extinguisher, and I've never had to use one for anything. And and you're right. It's like there's one level of protection. There's another level of protection. And if you're smart, you've got both levels of protection, you know? That's the way it goes. Yes, we've got the police, but I've got something on the off. There's a police station two blocks from me right here. I've had to call them twice since I've lived here, not for personal things, but for things that were happening around the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And each time, it's been 20 minutes before anybody got here. It's two blocks away. I could have walked over and talked them into coming over and then guided them back in that time.
Well, and look, I mean, part of that is the nature of law enforcement. It I don't know what priority these calls would have been, but you know, part of it, too, specifically in California, is the budgetary issues where the state does not want to invest, frankly, in the criminal justice system, whether it's prisons, whether it's the police departments, the staffing levels in some jurisdictions so low that, you know, in Oakland, California, you've been told for several years now, if you come home and you find out that your house has been burgled, don't call us. Don't call the police, because we don't have the manpower to send anybody out. Just try to write a report of what got taken. And you can go down to the local substation and you can fill out a report online and let us know. But CSI is not coming out to your house. They're not dusting for prints. They're not doing those things when you've been burgled, when somebody has broken in and stolen your stuff anymore.
Yeah, and it's there's always something, you know, we're the highest tax state all around in a lot of these municipalities where they're not being able to respond like that, or very high tax at the municipal level too. So it's, again, a case of how tax money is spent and why people like me are opposed to taxes in general, because in general they don't work. If they're spent wisely, they're spent wisely. There's plenty of money in this state to adequately fund our law enforcement. It's just that the people in charge choose not to.
Talking again with Mr. Stephen Cruiser from IJ Review. One more story for you, Stephen. At Harvey Mudd College in California, where is Harvey Mudd? Do you know?
I don't know. I've heard that name over the years, and I have no idea where it is.
About 800 students. Classes at Harvey Mudd shut down yesterday and today. The cancellation following a student sit-in last week at the campus where minority students issued demands to administration, among them to funnel more money into counseling services to prioritize minority student groups with funding and other perks. The students apparently did not ask for a cancellation, but the college president, Maria Clowey, said the college canceled classes to allow students and faculty members time to consider some of the persisting issues on campus or to, quote, recuperate after a tense few weeks there at Harvey Mudd. You know, this comes after we saw the big fight at Berkeley. Are California's, I mean, we talk about Berkeley and the soda tax, Stephen, are California's colleges headed for a crisis here? Is there a breakdown in authority or even law and order on these campuses in your state?
I think this is nationwide. I don't think it's just California. I think this is the kind of, you know, the students and their protests and their sit-ins and their this and their that started to gain a lot of a disproportionate amount of influence a few years ago. We saw it at the University of Missouri. We've seen it in places elsewhere in the country. And it really is almost a case of the inmates taking over the asylum. And the faculties started to imbue the student body with power that it really doesn't have. But they started kowtowing this. I mean, they started caving to the demands of the students. So you see this happening more and more in colleges all over the country. It's, you know, Berkeley's the epicenter for that kind of stuff. So it happens more there than anywhere else. But I think it's nationwide.
All right, Stephen, listen, the music means we are out of time. But thank you so much, sir, for spending some time with us today.
Always a pleasure.
Me too. Stephen Cruiser on Twitter again. Stephen Cruiser, Stephen with a PH, Cruiser with a K. We'll see you tomorrow, 2 p.m. Eastern on NRA TV for more Cam and Company.